Chapter 1 of The Shadow Line. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Peter Dan. The Shadow Line by Joseph Conrad. Chapter 1. Only the young have such moments. I don't mean the very young, no. The very young have, properly speaking, no moments. It is the privilege of early youth to live in advance of its days, in all the beautiful continuity of hope which knows no pauses and no introspection. One closes behind one the little gate of mere boyishness, and enters into an enchanted garden. Its very shades glow with promise. Every turn of the path has its seduction. And it isn't because it is an undiscovered country. One knows well enough that all mankind has streamed that way. It is the charm of universal experience from which one expects an uncommon or personal sensation, a bit of one's own. One goes on, recognizing the landmarks of the predecessors, excited, amused, taking the hard luck and the good luck together. The kicks and the halfpence, as the saying is, the picturesque common lot that holds so many possibilities for the deserving, or perhaps for the lucky. Yes, one goes on. And the time, too, goes on, till one perceives ahead a shadow line, warning one that the region of early youth, too, must be left behind. This is the period of life in which such moments of which I have spoken are likely to come. What moments? Why, the moments of boredom, of weariness, of dissatisfaction. Rash moments. I mean moments when the still young are inclined to commit rash actions, such as getting married suddenly, or else throwing up a job for no reason. This is not a marriage story. It wasn't so bad as that with me. My action, rash as it was, had more the character of divorce, almost of desertion. For no reason on which a sensible person could put a finger, I threw up my job, chucked my berth, left the ship, of which the worst that could be said was that she was a steamship, and therefore perhaps not entitled to that blind loyalty which... However, it's no use trying to put a gloss on what even at the time I myself half suspected to be a caprice. It was in an eastern port. She was an eastern ship, inasmuch as then she belonged to that port. She traded among dark islands on a blue reef-scarred sea, with a red ensign over the taffrail, and at her masthead a house flag, also red, but with a green border and with a white crescent in it. For an Arab owned her, and a Sayyid at that. Hence the green border on the flag. He was the head of a great house of Straits Arabs, but as loyal a subject of the complex British Empire as you could find east of the Suez Canal. World politics did not trouble him at all, but he had a great occult power amongst his own people. It was all one to us who owned the ship. He had to employ white men in the shipping part of his business, and many of those he so employed had never set eyes on him from the first to the last day. I myself saw him but once, quite accidentally, on a wharf, an old, dark little man, blind in one eye, in a snowy robe and yellow slippers. He was having his hand severely kissed by a crowd of Malay pilgrims to whom he had done some favour in the way of food and money. His almsgiving, I have heard, was most extensive, covering almost the whole archipelago. For isn't it said that the charitable man is the friend of Allah? Excellent and picturesque Arab owner, about whom one needed not to trouble one's head. A most excellent Scottish ship, for she was that from the keep up. Excellent sea-boat, easy to keep clean, most handy in every way, and if it had not been for her internal propulsion, worthy of any man's love. I cherish to this day a profound respect for her memory. As to the kind of trade she was engaged in and the character of my shipmates, I could not have been happier if I had had the life and the men made to my order by a benevolent enchanter. And suddenly I left all this. I left it in that, to us, inconsequential manner in which a bird flies away from a comfortable branch. It was as though, all unknowing, I had heard a whisper or seen something. Well, perhaps. One day I was perfectly right, and the next everything was gone. Glamour, flavour, interest, contentment, everything. It was one of these moments, you know, the green sickness of late youth descended on me and carried me off. Carried me off that ship, I mean. We were only four white men on board, with a large crew of calashes and two Malay petty officers. The captain stared hard, as if wondering what ailed me. but he was a sailor, and he too had been young at one time. Presently a smile came to lurk under his thick iron-grey moustache, and he observed that, of course, if I felt I must go, he couldn't keep me by main force. And it was arranged that I should be paid off the next morning. As I was going out of his cabin, he added suddenly, in a peculiar, wistful tone, that he hoped I would find what I was so anxious to go and look for. A soft, cryptic utterance, which seemed to reach deeper than any diamond-hard tool could have done. I do believe he understood my case. But the second engineer attacked me differently. He was a sturdy young Scot with a smooth face and light eyes. His honest red countenance emerged out of the engine-room companion, and then the whole robust man, with shirt-sleeves turned up, wiping slowly the massive forearms with a lump of cotton waste. And his light eyes expressed bitter distaste, as though our friendship had turned to ashes. He said weightily, "Oh, aye, I've been thinking it was about time for you to run away home and get married to some silly girl." It was tacitly understood in the port that John Nevin was a fierce misogynist, and the absurd character of the sally convinced me that he meant to be nasty, very nasty, had meant to say the most crushing thing he could think of. My laugh sounded deprecatory. Nobody but a friend could be so angry as that. I became a little crestfallen. Our chief engineer also took a characteristic view of my action, but in a kindlier spirit. He was young too, but very thin, and with a mist of fluffy brown beard all round his haggard face. All day long, at sea or in harbour, he could be seen walking hastily up and down the after-deck, wearing an intense, spiritually rapt expression, which was caused by a perpetual consciousness of unpleasant physical sensations in his internal economy. For he was a confirmed dyspeptic. His view of my case was very simple. He said it was nothing but deranged liver. Of course. He suggested I should stay for another trip, and meantime dose myself with a certain patent medicine in which his own belief was absolute. "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll buy you 2 bottles out of my own pocket. There, I can't say fairer than that, can I?" I believe he would have perpetrated the atrocity, or generosity, at the merest sign of weakening on my part. By that time, however, I was more discontented, disgusted, and dogged than ever. The past 18 months, so full of new and varied experience, appeared a dreary, prosaic waste of days. I felt, how shall I express it, that there was no truth to be got out of them. What truth? I should have been hard put to it to explain. Probably, if pressed, I would have burst into tears simply. I was young enough for that. Next day, the captain and I transacted our business in the harbour office. It was a lofty, big, cool, white room, where the screened light of day glowed serenely. Everybody in it, the officials, the public, were in white. Only the heavy, polished desks gleamed darkly in a central avenue, and some papers lying on them were blue. Enormous punkers sent from on high a gentle draught through that immaculate interior and upon our perspiring heads. The official behind the desk we approached grinned amiably and kept it up till, in answer to his perfunctory question, "Sign off and on again," my captain answered, "No, signing off for good." And then his grin vanished in sudden solemnity. He did not look at me again till he handed me my papers with a sorrowful expression, as if they had been my passports for Hades. While I was putting them away, he murmured some question to the captain, and I heard the latter answer good-humouredly, "No, he leaves us to go home." "Oh," the other exclaimed, nodding mournfully over my sad condition. I didn't know him outside the official building, but he leaned toward the desk to shake hands with me, compassionately, as one would with some poor devil going out to be hanged, and I am afraid I performed my part ungraciously, in the hardened manner of an impenitent criminal. No homeward-bound mailboat was due for 3 or 4 days. Being now a man without a ship, and having for a time broken my connection with the sea, become, in fact, a mere potential passenger, it would have been more appropriate, perhaps, if I had gone to stay at an hotel. There it was, too, within a stone's throw of the harbour office, low, but somehow palatial, displaying its white pillared pavilion surrounded by trim grass plots. I would have felt a passenger indeed in there. I gave it a hostile glance and directed my steps towards the officer's sailor's home. I walked in the sunshine, disregarding it, and in the shade of the big trees on the esplanade, without enjoying it. The heat of the tropical east descended through the leafy boughs, enveloping my thinly clad body, clinging to my rebellious discontent as if to rob it of its freedom. The officer's home was a large bungalow with a wide veranda and a curiously suburban-looking little garden of bushes and a few trees between it and the street. That institution partook somewhat of the character of a residential club, but with a slightly governmental flavour about it, because it was administered by the Harbour Office. Its manager was officially styled Chief Steward. He was an unhappy, wizened little man who, if put into a jockey's rig, would have looked the part to perfection. But it was obvious that at some time or other in his life, in some capacity or other, he had been connected with the sea, possibly in the comprehensive capacity of a failure. I should have thought his employment a very easy one, but he used to affirm for some reason or other that his job would be the death of him some day. It was rather mysterious. Perhaps everything, naturally, was too much trouble for him. He certainly seemed to hate having people in the house. On entering it, I thought he must be feeling pleased. It was as still as a tomb. I could see no one in the living rooms, and the veranda too was empty, except for a man at the far end, dozing prone in a long chair. At the noise of my footsteps, he opened one horribly fish-like eye. He was a stranger to me. I retreated from there, and crossing the dining room, a very bare apartment with a motionless punkah hanging over the centre table, I knocked at a door labelled in black letters, Chief Steward. The answer to my knock being a vexed and doleful plaint, oh dear, what is it now? I went in at once. It was a strange room to find in the tropics. Twilight and stuffiness reigned in there. The fellow had hung enormously ample, dusty, cheap lace curtains over his windows, which were shut. Piles of cardboard boxes, such as milliners and dressmakers use in Europe, cumbered the corners, and by some means he had procured for himself the sort of furniture that might have come out of a respectable parlour in the East End of London, a horsehair sofa, armchairs of the same. I glimpsed grimy antimacassars scattered over that horrid upholstery, which was awe-inspiring, insomuch that one could not guess what mysterious accident, need, or fancy had collected it there. Its owner had taken off his tunic, and in white trousers and a thin, short-sleeved singlet, prowled behind the chair-backs, nursing his meagre elbows. An exclamation of dismay escaped him when he heard that I had come for a stay, but he could not deny that there were plenty of vacant rooms. "Very well. Can you give me the one I had before?" He emitted a faint moan from behind a pile of cardboard boxes on the table, which might have contained gloves or handkerchiefs or neckties. I wonder what the fellow did keep in them. There was a smell of decaying coral, of oriental dust, of zoological specimens in that den of his. I could only see the top of his head and his unhappy eyes levelled at me over the barrier. "It's only for a couple of days," I said, intending to cheer him up. "Perhaps you would like to pay in advance," he suggested eagerly. "Certainly not," I burst out directly I could speak. "Never heard of such a thing. This is the most infernal cheek!" He had seized his head in both hands, a gesture of despair which checked my indignation. "Oh, dear, don't fly out like this. I'm asking everybody." "I don't believe it," I said bluntly. "Well, I'm going to, and if you gentlemen all agreed to pay in advance, I could make Hamilton pay up, too. He's always turning up ashore dead broke, and even when he has some money he won't settle his bills. I don't know what to do with him. He swears at me and tells me I can't chuck a white man out into the streets here. So if you only would—" I was amazed, incredulous too. I suspected the fellow of gratuitous impertinence. I told him with marked emphasis that I would see him and Hamilton hanged first, and requested him to conduct me to my room with no more of his nonsense. He produced then a key from somewhere and led the way out of his lair, giving me a vicious sidelong look in passing. "Anyone I know staying here?" I asked him before he left my room. He had recovered his usual pained, impatient tone, and said that Captain Giles was there, back from a solo sea trip. Two other guests were staying also. He paused. "And, of course, Hamilton," he added. "Oh, yes, Hamilton," I said, and the miserable creature took himself off with a final groan. His impudence still rankled when I came into the dining room at tiffin time. He was there on duty overlooking the Chinaman servants. The tiffin was laid on one end only of the long table, and the punkah was stirring the hot air lazily, mostly above a barren waste of polished wood. We were four around the cloth. The dozing stranger from the chair was one. Both his eyes were partly opened now, but they did not seem to see anything. He was supine. The dignified person next him, with short side whiskers and a carefully scraped chin, was, of course, Hamilton. I had never seen anyone so full of dignity for the station in life Providence had been pleased to place him in. I was told that he regarded me as a rank outsider. He raised not only his eyes, but his eyebrows as well, at the sound I made, pulling back my chair. Captain Giles was at the head of the table. I exchanged a few words of greeting with him and sat down on his left. Stout and pale, with a great shiny dome of a bald forehead and prominent brown eyes, he might have been anything but a seaman. You would not have been surprised to learn that he was an architect. To me, I know how absurd it is, he looked like a churchwarden. He had the appearance of a man from whom you would expect sound advice, moral sentiments, with perhaps a platitude or two thrown in on occasion, not from a desire to dazzle, but from honest conviction. Though very well known and appreciated in the shipping world, he had no regular employment. He did not want it. He had his own peculiar position. He was an expert in, how shall I say it, in intricate navigation. He was supposed to know more about remote and imperfectly charted parts of the archipelago than any man living. His brain must have been a perfect warehouse of reefs, positions, bearings, images of headlands, shapes of obscure coasts, aspects of innumerable islands, desert and otherwise. Any ship, for instance, bound on a trip to Palawan or somewhere that way would have Captain Giles on board, either in temporary command or to assist the master. It was said that he had a retaining fee from a wealthy firm of Chinese steamship owners in view of such services. Besides, he was always ready to relieve any man who wished to take a spell ashore for a time. No owner was ever known to object to an arrangement of that sort, for it seemed to be the established opinion at the port that Captain Giles was as good as the best, if not a little better. But in Hamilton's view, he was an outsider. I believe that for Hamilton the generalization outsider covered the whole lot of us, though I suppose that he made some distinctions in his mind. I didn't try to make conversation with Captain Giles, whom I had not seen more than twice in my life. But of course he knew who I was. After a while, inclining his big shiny head my way, he addressed me first in his friendly fashion. He presumed from seeing me there, he said, that I had come ashore for a couple of days' leave. He was a low-voiced man. I spoke a little louder, saying that, no, I had left the ship for good. "A free man for a bit," was his comment. "I suppose I may call myself that, since 11 o'clock," I said. Hamilton had stopped eating at the sound of our voices. He laid down his knife and fork gently, got up, and, muttering something about this infernal heat cutting one's appetite, went out of the room. Almost immediately we heard him leave the house, down the veranda steps. On this, Captain Giles remarked easily that the fellow had no doubt gone off to look after my old job. The chief steward, who had been leaning against the wall, brought his face of an unhappy goat nearer to the table and addressed us dolefully. His object was to unburden himself of his eternal grievance against Hamilton. The man kept him in hot water with the harbour office as to the state of his accounts. He wished to goodness he would get my job, though in truth what would it be? Temporary relief at best. I said, "You needn't worry. He won't get my job. My successor is on board already." He was surprised, and I believe his face fell a little at the news. Captain Giles gave a soft laugh. We got up and went out on the veranda, leaving the supine stranger to be dealt with by the Chinaman. The last thing I saw, they had put a plate with a slice of pineapple on it before him and stood back to watch what would happen. But the experiment seemed a failure. He sat insensible. It was imparted to me in a low voice by Captain Giles that this was an officer of some Rajah's yacht which had come into our port to be dry-docked. "Must have been seeing life last night," he added, wrinkling his nose in an intimate, confidential way, which pleased me vastly. For Captain Giles had prestige. He was credited with wonderful adventures and with some mysterious tragedy in his life. And no man had a word to say against him. He continued, "I remember him first coming ashore here some years ago. Seems only the other day. He was a nice boy. Oh, these nice boys. I could not help laughing aloud. He looked startled, then joined in the laugh. No, no, I didn't mean that, he cried. What I meant is that some of them do go soft, mighty quick out here. Jocularly, I suggested the beastly heat as the first cause. But Captain Giles disclosed himself possessed of a deeper philosophy. Things out east were made easy for white men. That was all right. The difficulty was to go on keeping white, and some of these nice boys did not know how. He gave me a searching look, and in the benevolent, heavy uncle manner asked point blank, "Why did you throw up your berth?" I became angry all of a sudden, for you can understand how exasperating such a question was to a man who didn't know. I said to myself that I ought to shut up that moralist, and to him aloud I said with challenging politeness, "Why, do you disapprove?" He was too disconcerted to do more than mutter confusedly, "Aye, in a general way," and then gave me up. But he retired in good order, under the cover of a heavily humorous remark that he too was getting soft, and that this was his time for taking his little siesta when he was on shore. Very bad habit, very bad habit. There was a simplicity in the man which would have disarmed a touchiness even more youthful than mine. So when, next day at tiffin, he bent his head towards me and said that he had met my late captain last evening, adding in an undertone, "He's very sorry you left. He had never had a mate that suited him so well." I answered him earnestly, without any affectation, that I certainly hadn't been so comfortable in any ship or with any commander in all my sea-going days. "Well, then," he murmured, "haven't you heard, Captain Giles, that I intend to go home?" "Yes," he said benevolently, "I have heard that sort of thing so often before." "What of that?" I cried. I thought he was the most dull, unimaginative man I had ever met. I don't know what more I could have said, but the much-belated Hamilton came in just then and took his usual seat, so I dropped into a mumble. "Anyhow, you shall see it done this time." Hamilton, beautifully shaved, gave Captain Giles a curt nod, but didn't even condescend to raise his eyebrows at me, and when he spoke it was only to tell the chief steward that the food on his plate wasn't fit to be set before a gentleman. The individual addressed seemed much too unhappy to groan. He cast his eyes up to the punkah, and that was all. Captain Giles and I got up from the table, and the stranger next to Hamilton followed our example, manoeuvring himself to his feet with difficulty. He, poor fellow, not because he was hungry, but I verily believe only to recover his self-respect, had tried to put some of that unworthy food into his mouth. But after dropping his fork twice and generally making a failure of it, he had sat still with an air of intense mortification, combined with a ghastly glazed stare. Both Giles and I had avoided looking his way at table. On the veranda, he stopped short on purpose to address to us anxiously a long remark which I failed to understand completely. It sounded like some horrible unknown language. But when Captain Giles, after only an instant for reflection, assured him with a homely friendliness, "Aye, to be sure, you are right there," he appeared very much gratified indeed, and went away, pretty straight too, to seek a distant long chair. "What was he trying to say?" I asked with disgust. "I don't know. Mustn't be down too much on a fellow. He's feeling pretty wretched, you may be sure, and tomorrow he'll feel worse yet." Judging by the man's appearance, it seemed impossible. I wondered what sort of complicated debauch had reduced him to that unspeakable condition. Captain Giles' benevolence was spoiled by a curious air of complacency which I disliked. I said with a little laugh, "Well, he will have you to look after him." He made a deprecatory gesture, sat down, and took up a paper. I did the same. The papers were old and uninteresting, filled up mostly with dreary, stereotyped descriptions of Queen Victoria's first Jubilee celebrations. Probably we should have quickly fallen into a tropical afternoon doze if it had not been for Hamilton's voice raised in the dining-room. He was finishing his tiffin there. The big double doors stood wide open permanently, and he could not have had any idea how near to the doorway our chairs were placed. He was heard in a loud, supercilious tone answering some statement ventured by the chief steward. "I'm not going to be rushed into anything. They will be glad enough to get a gentleman, I imagine. There is no hurry." A loud whispering from the steward succeeded, and then again Hamilton was heard with even intenser scorn. "What, That young ass who fancies himself for having been chief mate with Kent so long. Preposterous. Giles and I looked at each other. Kent being the name of my late commander, Captain Giles Whisper, "He's talking of you," seemed to me sheer waste of breath. The chief steward must have stuck to his point, whatever it was, because Hamilton was heard again, more supercilious, if possible, and also very emphatic. "Rubbish, my good man. One doesn't compete with a rank outsider like that. There's plenty of time." Then there was pushing of chairs, footsteps in the next room, and plaintive expostulations from the steward, who was pursuing Hamilton, even out of doors, through the main entrance. "That's a very insulting sort of man," remarked Captain Giles, superfluously, I thought. "Very insulting. You haven't offended him in some way, have you?" "Never spoke to him in my life," I said grumpily. "Can't imagine what he means by competing. He's been trying to get my job after I left, and didn't get it. But that isn't exactly competition." Captain Giles balanced his big, benevolent head thoughtfully. "He didn't get it," he repeated very slowly. "No, not likely either, with Kent. Kent is no end sorry you left him. He gives you the name of a good seaman, too." I flung away the paper I was still holding. I sat up. I slapped the table with my open palm. I wanted to know why he would keep harping on that, my absolutely private affair. It was exasperating, really. Captain Giles silenced me by the perfect equanimity of his gaze. "Nothing to be annoyed about," he murmured reasonably, with an evident desire to soothe the childish irritation he had aroused. And he was really a man of an appearance so inoffensive that I tried to explain myself as much as I could. I told him that I did not want to hear any more about what was past and gone. It had been very nice while it lasted, but now it was done with, I preferred not to talk about it or even think about it. I had made up my mind to go home. He listened to the whole tirade in a particular lending-the-ear attitude, as if trying to detect a false note in it somewhere, then straightened himself up and appeared to ponder sagaciously over the matter. "Yes, you told me you meant to go home. Anything in view there?" Instead of telling him that it was none of his business, I said sullenly, "Nothing that I know of." I had indeed considered that rather blank side of the situation I had created for myself by leaving suddenly my very satisfactory employment, and I was not very pleased with it. I had it on the tip of my tongue to say that common sense had nothing to do with my action, and that therefore it didn't deserve the interest Captain Giles seemed to be taking in it. But he was puffing at a short wooden pipe now, and looked so guileless, dense, and commonplace, that it seemed hardly worth while to puzzle him either with truth or sarcasm. He blew a cloud of smoke, then surprised me by a very abrupt, "Paid your passage money yet?" Overcome by the shameless pertinacity of a man to whom it was rather difficult to be rude, I replied with exaggerated meekness that I had not done so yet. I thought there would be plenty of time to do that tomorrow. And I was about to turn away, withdrawing my privacy from his fatuous, objectless attempts to test what sort of stuff I was made of, when he laid down his pipe in an extremely significant manner, you know, as if a critical moment had come, and leant sideways over the table between us. "Oh, you haven't yet?" He dropped his voice mysteriously. "Well, then I think you ought to know that there's something going on here." I'd never in my life felt more detached from all earthly goings-on. Freed from the sea for a time, I preserved the sailor's consciousness of complete independence from all land affairs. How could they concern me? I gazed at Captain Giles' animation with scorn rather than with curiosity. To his obviously preparatory question whether our steward had spoken to me that day, I said he hadn't, and what's more, he would have had precious little encouragement if he had tried to. I didn't want the fellow to speak to me at all. Unrebuked by my petulance, Captain Giles, with an air of immense sagacity, began to tell me a minute tale about a harbour office peon. It was absolutely pointless. A peon was seen walking that morning on the veranda with a letter in his hand. It was in an official envelope. As the habit of these fellows is, he had shown it to the first white man he came across. That man was our friend in the armchair. He, as I knew, was not in a state to interest himself in any sublunary matters. He could only wave the peon away. The peon then wandered on along the veranda and came upon Captain Giles, who was there by an extraordinary chance. At this point he stopped with a profound look. The letter, he continued, was addressed to the chief steward. Now what could Captain Ellis, the master attendant, want to write to the steward for? The fellow went every morning anyhow to the harbour office with his report, for orders or what not. He hadn't been back more than an hour before there was an office peon chasing him with a note. Now what was that for? And he began to speculate. It was not for this, and it could not be for that. As to that other thing, it was unthinkable. The fatuousness of all this made me stare. If the man had not been somehow a sympathetic personality, I would have resented it like an insult. As it was, I only felt sorry for him. Something remarkably earnest in his gaze prevented me from laughing in his face. Neither did I yawn at him. I just stared. His tone became a shade more mysterious. Directly the fellow, meaning the steward, got that note, he rushed to his hat and bolted out of the house. But it wasn't because the note called him to the harbour office. He didn't go there. He was not absent long enough for that. He came darting back in no time, flung his hat away, and raced about the dining room, moaning and slapping his forehead. All these exciting facts and manifestations had been observed by Captain Giles. He had, it seems, been meditating upon them ever since. I began to pity him profoundly, and in a tone which I tried to make as little sarcastic as possible, I said that I was glad he had found something to occupy his morning hours. With his disarming simplicity, he made me observe, as if it were a matter of some consequence, how strange it was that he should have spent the morning indoors at all. He generally was out before tiffin, visiting various offices, seeing his friends in the harbour, and so on. He had felt out of sorts somewhat on rising. Nothing much, just enough to make him feel lazy. All this with a sustained holding stare, which, in conjunction with the general inanity of the discourse, conveyed the impression of mild, dreary lunacy. And when he hitched his chair a little and dropped his voice to the low note of mystery, it flashed upon me that high professional reputation was not necessarily a guarantee of sound mind. It never occurred to me then that I didn't know in what soundness of mind exactly consisted, and what a delicate and, upon the whole, unimportant matter it was. With some idea of not hurting his feelings, I blinked at him in an interested manner. But when he proceeded to ask me mysteriously whether I remembered what had passed just now between that steward of ours and that man Hamilton, I only grunted sourly assent and turned away my head. "Aye, but do you remember every word?" he insisted tactfully. "I don't know. It's none of my business," I snapped out, consigning, moreover, the steward and Hamilton aloud to eternal perdition. I meant to be very energetic and final, but Captain Giles continued to gaze at me thoughtfully. Nothing could stop him. He went on to point out that my personality was involved in that conversation. When I tried to preserve the semblance of unconcern, he became positively cruel. "I heard what the man had said, yes? What did I think of it, then?" he wanted to know. Captain Giles' appearance, excluding the suspicion of mere sly malice, I came to the conclusion that he was simply the most tactless idiot on earth. I almost despised myself for the weakness of attempting to enlighten his common understanding. I started to explain that I did not think anything whatever. Hamilton was not worth a thought. What such an offensive loafer, aye, that he is, interjected Captain Giles, thought or said was below any decent man's contempt, and I did not propose to take the slightest notice of it. This attitude seemed to me so simple and obvious that I was really astonished at Giles giving no sign of assent. Such perfect stupidity was almost interesting. "What would you like me to do?" I asked, laughing. "I can't start a row with him because of the opinion he has formed of me. Of course I've heard of the contemptuous way he alludes to me, but he doesn't intrude his contempt on my notice. He has never expressed it in my hearing, for even just now he didn't know we could hear him. I should only make myself ridiculous." That hopeless Giles went on puffing at his pipe moodily. All at once his face cleared, and he spoke. "You missed my point." "Have I? I'm very glad to hear it," I said. With increasing animation, he stated again that I had missed his point entirely. and in a tone of growing self-conscious complacency, he told me that few things escaped his attention, and he was rather used to think them out, and generally, from his experience of life and men, arrived at the right conclusion. This bit of self-praise, of course, fitted excellently the laborious inanity of the whole conversation. The whole thing strengthened in me that obscure feeling of life being but a waste of days, which half unconsciously had driven me out of a comfortable berth, away from men I liked, to flee from the menace of emptiness, and to find inanity at the first turn. Here was a man of recognized character and achievement, disclosed as an absurd and dreary chatterer. And it was probably like this everywhere, from east to west, from the bottom to the top of the social scale. A great discouragement fell on me, a spiritual drowsiness. Giles' voice was going on complacently, the very voice of the universal hollow conceit, and I was no longer angry with it. There was nothing original, nothing new, startling, informing, to expect from the world, no opportunities to find out something about oneself, no wisdom to acquire, no fun to enjoy. Everything was stupid and overrated, even as Captain Giles was. So be it. The name of Hamilton suddenly caught my ear and roused me up. "I thought we had done with him," I said with the greatest possible distaste. "Yes, but considering what we happened to hear just now, I think you ought to do it." "Ought to do it?" I said, bewildered. "Do what?" Captain Giles confronted me very much surprised. "Why, do what I've been advising you to try. You go and ask the steward what was there in that letter from the harbour office. Ask him, straight out." I remained speechless for a time. Here was something unexpected and original enough to be altogether incomprehensible. I murmured, astounded. "But I thought it was Hamilton that you..." "Exactly. Don't you let him. You do what I tell you. You tackle that steward. You'll make him jump, I bet," insisted Captain Giles, waving his smouldering pipe impressively at me. Then he took three rapid puffs at it. His aspect of triumphant acuteness was indescribable. Yet the man remained a strangely sympathetic creature. Benevolence radiated from him, ridiculously, mildly, impressively. It was irritating, too. But I pointed out coldly, as one who deals with the incomprehensible, that I didn't see any reason to expose myself to a snub from the fellow. He was a very unsatisfactory steward and a miserable wretch, besides, but I would just as soon think of tweaking his nose. "Tweaking his nose," said Captain Giles in a scandalized tone. "Much use it would be to you." That remark was so irrelevant that one could make no answer to it. But the sense of the absurdity was beginning at last to exercise its well-known fascination. I felt I must not let the man talk to me any more. I got up, observing curtly that he was too much for me, that I couldn't make him out. Before I had time to move away, he spoke again in a changed tone of obstinacy and puffing nervously at his pipe. "Well, he's a no-account cuss, anyhow. You just ask him, that's all." That new manner impressed me, or rather made me pause. But sanity asserting its sway at once, I left the veranda after giving him a mirthless smile. In a few strides I found myself in the dining room, now cleared and empty. But during that short time various thoughts occurred to me, such as that Giles had been making fun of me, expecting some amusement at my expense, that I probably looked silly and gullible, that I knew very little of life. The door facing me across the dining room flew open to my extreme surprise. It was the door inscribed with the word steward, and the man himself ran out of his stuffy, philistinish lair in his absurd, hunted animal manner, making for the garden door. To this day I don't know what made me call after him. "I say, wait a minute." Perhaps it was the sidelong glance he gave me, or possibly I was yet under the influence of Captain Giles' mysterious earnestness. Well, it was an impulse of some sort, an effect of that force somewhere within our lives which shapes them this way or that. For if these words had not escaped from my lips, my will had nothing to do with that, my existence would, to be sure, have been still a seaman's existence, but directed on now, to me, utterly inconceivable lines. No, my will had nothing to do with it. Indeed, no sooner had I made that fateful noise than I became extremely sorry for it. Had the man stopped and faced me, I would have had to retire in disorder. for I had no notion to carry out Captain Giles' idiotic joke, either at my own expense or at the expense of the steward. But here the old human instinct of the chase came into play. He pretended to be deaf, and I, without thinking a second about it, dashed along my side of the dining table and cut him off at the very door. "Why can't you answer when you are spoken to?" I asked roughly. He leant against the lintel of the door. He looked extremely wretched. Human nature is, I fear, not very nice right through. There are ugly spots in it. I found myself growing angry, and that, I believe, only because my quarry looked so woebegone. Miserable beggar. I went for him without more ado. "I understand there was an official communication to the Home from the Harbour Office this morning. Is that so?" Instead of telling me to mind my own business, as he might have done, he began to whine with an undertone of impudence. "He couldn't see me anywhere this morning. He couldn't be expected to run all over the town after me." "Who wants you to?" I cried. And then my eyes became open to the inwardness of things, and speeches the triviality of which had been so baffling and tiresome. I told him I wanted to know what was in that letter. My sternness of tone and behaviour was only half assumed. Curiosity can be a very fierce sentiment at times. He took refuge in a silly, muttering sulkiness. "It was nothing to me," he mumbled. "I had told him I was going home, and since I was going home, he didn't see why he should." That was the line of his argument, and it was irrelevant enough to be almost insulting. Insulting to one's intelligence, I mean. In that twilight region between youth and maturity in which I had my being then, one is peculiarly sensitive to that kind of insult. I'm afraid my behaviour to the steward became very rough indeed, but it wasn't in him to face out anything or anybody. Drug habit or solitary tippling, perhaps. And when I forgot myself so far as to swear at him, he broke down and began to shriek. I don't mean to say that he made a great outcry. It was a cynical, shrieking confession, only faint, piteously faint. It wasn't very coherent either, but sufficiently so to strike me dumb at first. I turned my eyes from him in righteous indignation, and perceived Captain Giles in the veranda doorway, surveying quietly the scene, his own handiwork, if I may express it in that way. His smouldering black pipe was very noticeable in his big paternal fist. So too was the glitter of his heavy gold watch-chain across the breast of his white tunic. He exhaled an atmosphere of virtuous sagacity, serene enough for any innocent soul to fly to confidently. I flew to him. "You would never believe it," I cried. "It was a notification that a master is wanted for some ship. There's a command apparently going about, and this fellow puts the thing in his pocket." The steward screamed out in accents of loud despair, "You will be the death of me!" The mighty slap he gave his wretched forehead was very loud, too. But when I turned to look at him, he was no longer there. He had rushed away somewhere out of sight. This sudden disappearance made me laugh. This was the end of the incident, for me. Captain Giles, however, staring at the place where the steward had been, began to haul at his gorgeous gold chain till at last the watch came up from the deep pocket like solid truth from a well. Solemnly he lowered it down again, and only then said, "Just 3 o'clock. You will be in time, if you don't lose any, that is." "In time for what?" I asked. "Good Lord, for the Harbour Office. This must be looked into." Strictly speaking, he was right. But I've never had much taste for investigation, for showing people up and all that, no doubt, ethically meritorious kind of work. And my view of the episode was purely ethical. If anyone had to be the death of the steward, I didn't see why it shouldn't be Captain Giles himself, a man of age and standing and a permanent resident. Whereas I, in comparison, felt myself a mere bird of passage in that port. In fact, it might have been said that I had already broken off my connection. I muttered that I didn't think. It was nothing to me. "Nothing," repeated Captain Giles, giving some signs of quiet, deliberate indignation. "Kent warned me that you were a peculiar young fellow. You will tell me next that a command is nothing to you, and after all the trouble I've taken, too." "The trouble?" I murmured, uncomprehending. "What trouble?" All I could remember was being mystified and bored by his conversation for a solid hour after tiffin, and he called that taking a lot of trouble. He was looking at me with a self-complacency which would have been odious in any other man. All at once, as if a page of a book had been turned over, disclosing a word which made plain all that had gone before, I perceived that this matter had also another than an ethical aspect. And still I did not move. Captain Giles lost his patience a little. With an angry puff at his pipe, he turned his back on my hesitation. But it was not hesitation on my part. I had been, if I may express myself so, put out of gear mentally. But as soon as I had convinced myself that this stale, unprofitable world of my discontent contained such a thing as a command to be seized, I recovered my powers of locomotion. It's a good step from the officer's home to the harbour office, but with the magic word command in my head, I found myself suddenly on the quay, as if transported there in the twinkling of an eye, before a portal of dressed white stone above a flight of shallow white steps. All this seemed to glide towards me swiftly. The whole great roadstead to the right was just a mere flicker of blue, and the dim, cool hall swallowed me up out of the heat and glare of which I had not been aware till the very moment I passed in from it. The broad inner staircase insinuated itself under my feet somehow. Command is a strong magic. The first human beings I perceived distinctly since I had parted with the indignant back of Captain Giles were the crew of the harbour steam launch lounging on the spacious landing about the curtained archway of the shipping office. It was there that my buoyancy abandoned me. The atmosphere of officialdom would kill anything that breathes the air of human endeavour, would extinguish hope and fear alike in the supremacy of paper and ink. I passed heavily under the curtain which the Malay coxswain of the harbour launch raised for me. There was nobody in the office except the clerks, writing in two industrious rows. But the head shipping master hopped down from his elevation and hurried along on the thick mats to meet me in the broad central passage. He had a Scottish name, but his complexion was of a rich olive hue. His short beard was jet black, and his eyes, also black, had a languishing expression. He asked confidentially, "You want to see him?" All lightness of spirit and body having departed from me at the touch of officialdom, I looked at the scribe without animation, and asked in my turn wearily, "What do you think? Is it any use?" "My goodness, he has asked for you twice today." This emphatic he was the supreme authority, the marine superintendent, the harbour master. A very great person in the eyes of every single quill driver in the room. But that was nothing to the opinion he had of his own greatness. Captain Ellis looked upon himself as a sort of divine pagan emanation, the deputy Neptune for the circumambient seas. If he did not actually rule the waves, he pretended to rule the fate of the mortals whose lives were cast upon the waters. This uplifting illusion made him inquisitorial and peremptory. And as his temperament was choleric, there were fellows who were actually afraid of him. He was redoubtable, not in virtue of his office, but because of his unwarrantable assumptions. I had never had anything to do with him before. I said, "Oh, he has asked for me twice. Then perhaps I had better go in." "You must, you must." The shipping master led the way with a mincing gait around the whole system of desks to a tall and important-looking door, which he opened with a deferential action of the arm. He stepped right in, but without letting go of the handle, and, after gazing reverently down the room for a while, beckoned me in by a silent jerk of the head. Then he slipped out at once and shut the door after me most delicately. Three lofty windows gave on the harbour. There was nothing in them but the dark blue sparkling sea and the paler luminous blue of the sky. My eye caught in the depths and distances of these blue tones the white speck of some big ship just arrived and about to anchor in the outer roadstead. A ship from home, after perhaps 90 days at sea. There is something touching about a ship coming in from sea and folding her white wings for a rest. The next thing I saw was the topknot of silver hair surmounting Captain Ellis's smooth red face, which would have been apoplectic if it hadn't had such a fresh appearance. Our deputy Neptune had no beard on his chin, and there was no trident to be seen standing in a corner anywhere, like an umbrella. But his hand was holding a pen, the official pen, far mightier than the sword in making or marring the fortune of simple toiling men. He was looking over his shoulder at my advance. When I had come well within range, he saluted me by a nerve-shattering, "Where have you been all this time?" As it was no concern of his, I did not take the slightest notice of the shot. I said simply that I had heard that there was a master needed for some vessel, and being a sailing ship man, I thought I would apply. He interrupted me. "Why, hang it, you are the right man for that job, if there had been 20 others after it. But no fear of that. They are all afraid to catch hold. That's what's the matter." He was very irritated. I said innocently, "Are they, sir? I wonder why." "Why," he fumed, "afraid of the sails, afraid of a white crew, too much trouble, too much work, too long out here. Easy life and deck chairs more their mark. Here I sit with the Consul General's cable before me and the only man fit for the job not to be found anywhere. I began to think you were funking it too." "I haven't been long getting to the office," I remarked calmly. "You have a good name out here, though," he growled savagely without looking at me. "I am very glad to hear it from you, sir," I said. "Yes, but you are not on the spot when you are wanted. You know you weren't. That steward of yours wouldn't dare to neglect a message from this office. Where the devil did you hide yourself for the best part of the day?" I only smiled kindly down on him, and he seemed to recollect himself and asked me to take a seat. He explained that the master of a British ship having died in Bangkok, the Consul General had cabled to him a request for a competent man to be sent out to take command. Apparently, in his mind, I was the man from the first, though for the looks of the thing the notification addressed to the sailors' home was general. An agreement had already been prepared. He gave it to me to read, and when I handed it back to him with the remark that I accepted its terms, the Deputy Neptune signed it, stamped it with his own exalted hand, folded it in four, it was a sheet of blue foolscap, and presented it to me, a gift of extraordinary potency, for, as I put it in my pocket, my head swam a little. "This is your appointment to the command," he said with a certain gravity. "An official appointment binding the owners to conditions which you have accepted. Now, when will you be ready to go?" I said I would be ready that very day, if necessary. He caught me at my word with great alacrity. The steamer Melita was leaving for Bangkok that evening about 7. He would request her captain officially to give me a passage and wait for me till 10 o'clock. Then he rose from his office chair, and I got up too. My head swam, there was no doubt about it, and I felt a certain heaviness of limbs as if they had grown bigger since I had sat down on that chair. I made my bow. A subtle change in Captain Ellis's manner became perceptible, as though he had laid aside the trident of Deputy Neptune. In reality, it was only his official pen that he had dropped on getting up. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of The Shadow Line by Joseph Conrad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. The Shadow Line, Chapter 2. He shook hands with me. "Well, there you are, on your own, appointed officially under my responsibility." He was actually walking with me to the door. What a distance off it seemed. I moved like a man in bonds. But we reached it at last. I opened it with a sensation of dealing with mere dream stuff, and then, at the last moment, the fellowship of seamen asserted itself, stronger than the difference of age and station. It asserted itself in Captain Ellis's voice. "Goodbye, and good luck to you," he said, so heartily that I could only give him a grateful glance. Then I turned and went out, never to see him again in my life. I had not made 3 steps into the outer office when I heard behind my back a gruff, loud, authoritative voice, the voice of our Deputy Neptune. It was addressing the shipping master, who, having let me in, had apparently remained hovering in the middle distance ever since. "Mr. R., let the harbour launch have steam up to take the captain here on board the Melita at 9:30 tonight." I was amazed at the startled alacrity of R.'s "Yes, sir." He ran before me out on the landing. My new dignity sat yet so lightly on me that I was not aware that it was I, the captain, the object of this last graciousness. It seemed as if all of a sudden a pair of wings had grown on my shoulders. I merely skimmed along the polished floor. But I was impressed. "I say," he exclaimed on the landing, while the Malay crew of the steam launch standing by looked stonily at the man for whom they were going to be kept on duty so late, away from their gambling, from their girls, or their purely domestic joys. "I say, his own launch. What have you done to him?" His stare was full of respectful curiosity. I was quite confounded. "Was it for me? I hadn't the slightest notion," I stammered out. He nodded many times. "Yes, and the last person who had it before you was a duke. So there." I think he expected me to faint on the spot. But I was in too much of a hurry for emotional displays. My feelings were already in such a whirl that this staggering information did not seem to make the slightest difference. It merely fell into the seething cauldron of my brain, and I carried it off with me after a short but effusive passage of leave-taking with R. The favour of the great throws an aureole round the fortunate object of its selection. That excellent man inquired whether he could do anything for me. He had known me only by sight, and he was well aware that he would never see me again. I was, in common with the other seamen of the port, merely a subject for official writing, filling up of forms with all the artificial superiority of a man of pen and ink to the men who grapple with realities outside the consecrated walls of official buildings. What ghosts we must have been to him! Mere symbols to juggle with in books and heavy registers, without brains and muscles and perplexities, something hardly useful and decidedly inferior. And he, the office hours being over, wanted to know if he could be of any use to me. I ought, properly speaking, I ought to have been moved to tears, but I did not even think of it. It was merely another miraculous manifestation of that day of miracles. I parted from him as if he were a mere symbol. I floated down the staircase. I floated out of the official and imposing portal. I went on, floating along. I use that word rather than the word flew because I have a distinct impression that, though uplifted in my aroused youth, my movements were deliberate enough. To that mixed white, brown, and yellow portion of mankind out abroad on their own affairs, I presented the appearance of a man walking rather sedately, and nothing in the way of abstraction could have equalled my deep detachment from the forms and colours of this world. It was, as it were, final. And yet, suddenly, I recognised Hamilton. I recognised him without effort, without a shock, without a start. There he was, strolling towards the harbour office with his stiff, arrogant dignity. His red face made him noticeable at a distance. It flamed over there, on the shady side of the street. He had perceived me, too. Something, unconscious exuberance of spirits, perhaps, moved me to wave my hand to him elaborately. This lapse from good taste happened before I was aware that I was capable of it. The impact of my impudence stopped him short, much as a bullet might have done. I verily believe he staggered, though as far as I could see he didn't actually fall. I had gone past in a moment and did not turn my head. I had forgotten his existence. The next 10 minutes might have been 10 seconds or 10 centuries for all my consciousness had to do with it. People might have been falling dead around me, houses crumbling, guns firing. I wouldn't have known. I was thinking, "By Jove, I have got it." It being the command. It had come about in a way utterly unforeseen in my modest daydreams. I perceived that my imagination had been running in conventional channels and that my hopes had always been drab stuff. I had envisaged a command as a result of a slow course of promotion in the employ of some highly respectable firm, the reward of faithful service. Well, faithful service was all right. One would naturally give that for one's own sake, for the sake of the ship, for the love of the life of one's choice, not for the sake of the reward. There is something distasteful in the notion of a reward. And now, here I had my command, absolutely in my pocket, in a way undeniable, indeed, but most unexpected, beyond my imaginings, outside all reasonable expectations, and even notwithstanding the existence of some sort of obscure intrigue to keep it away from me. It is true that the intrigue was feeble, but it helped the feeling of wonder, as if I had been specially destined for that ship I did not know, by some power higher than the prosaic agencies of the commercial world. A strange sense of exaltation began to creep into me. If I had worked for that command 10 years or more, there would have been nothing of the kind. I was a little frightened. "Let us be calm," I said to myself. Outside the door of the officer's home, the wretched steward seemed to be waiting for me. There was a broad flight of a few steps, and he ran to and fro on the top of it as if chained there, a distressed cur. He looked as though his throat were too dry for him to bark. I regret to say I stopped before going in. There had been a revolution in my moral nature. He waited, open-mouthed, breathless, while I looked at him for half a minute. "And you thought you could keep me out of it," I said scathingly. "You said you were going home," he squeaked miserably. "You said so. You said so." "I wonder what Captain Ellis will have to say to that excuse," I uttered slowly, with a sinister meaning. His lower jaw had been trembling all the time, and his voice was like the bleating of a sick goat.
"You've given me away. You've done for me."
Neither his distress nor yet the sheer absurdity of it was able to disarm me. It was the first instance of harm being attempted to be done to me, at any rate the first I had ever found out, and I was still young enough, still too much on this side of the shadow line, not to be surprised and indignant at such things. I gazed at him inflexibly. "Let the beggar suffer." He slapped his forehead, and I passed in, pursued into the dining-room by his screech.
"I always said you'd be the death of me."
This clamour not only overtook me, but went ahead, as it were, onto the veranda and brought out Captain Giles. He stood before me in the doorway in all the commonplace solidity of his wisdom. The gold chain glittered on his breast. He clutched a smouldering pipe. I extended my hand to him warmly, and he seemed surprised, but did respond heartily enough in the end, with a faint smile of superior knowledge which cut my thanks short as if with a knife. I don't think that more than one word came out, and even for that one, judging by the temperature of my face, I had blushed as if for a bad action. Assuming a detached tone, I wondered how on earth he had managed to spot the little underhand game that had been going on. He murmured complacently that there were but few things done in the town that he could not see the inside of, and as to this house, he had been using it off and on for nearly 10 years. Nothing that went on in it could escape his great experience. It had been no trouble to him, no trouble at all. Then, in his quiet, thick tone, he wanted to know if I had complained formally of the steward's action. I said that I hadn't, though indeed it was not for want of opportunity. Captain Ellis had gone for me bald-headed in a most ridiculous fashion for being out of the way when wanted. "Funny old gentleman," interjected Captain Giles. "What did you say to that?" I said simply that I came along the very moment I heard of his message. Nothing more. I didn't want to hurt the steward. I would scorn to harm such an object. No, I made no complaint, but I believe he thinks I've done so. Let him think. He's got a fright he won't forget in a hurry, for Captain Ellis would kick him out into the middle of Asia. "Wait a moment," said Captain Giles, leaving me suddenly. I sat down, feeling very tired, mostly in my head. Before I could start a train of thought, he stood again before me, murmuring the excuse that he had to go and put the fellow's mind at ease. I looked up with surprise, but in reality I was indifferent. He explained that he had found the steward lying face downward on the horsehair sofa. He was all right now. "He would not have died of fright," I said contemptuously. "No, but he might have taken an overdose out of one of them little bottles he keeps in his room," Captain Giles argued seriously. "The confounded fool has tried to poison himself once, a few years ago." "Really," I said without emotion, "he doesn't seem very fit to live, anyhow." "As to that, it may be said of a good many." "Don't exaggerate like this," I protested, laughing irritably. "But I wonder what this part of the world would do if you were to leave off looking after it, Captain Giles. He have got me a command and saved the steward's life in one afternoon. The way you should have taken all that interest in either of us is more than I can understand." Captain Giles remained silent for a minute, then gravely. "He's not a bad steward, really. He can find a good cook, at any rate. And what's more, he can keep him when found. I remember the cooks we had here before his time." I must have made a movement of impatience, because he interrupted himself with an apology for keeping me yarning there, while no doubt I needed all my time to get ready. What I really needed was to be alone for a bit. I seized this opening hastily. My bedroom was a quiet refuge in an apparently uninhabited wing of the building. Having absolutely nothing to do, for I had not unpacked my things, I sat down on the bed and abandoned myself to the influences of the hour, to the unexpected influences. At first I wondered at my state of mind. Why was I not more surprised? Why? Here I was, invested with a command in the twinkling of an eye, not in the common course of human affairs, but more as if by enchantment. I ought to have been lost in astonishment. But I wasn't. I was very much like people in fairy tales. Nothing ever astonishes them. When a fully appointed gala coach is produced out of a pumpkin to take her to a ball, Cinderella does not exclaim. She gets in quietly and drives away to her high fortune. Captain Ellis, a fierce sort of fairy, had produced a command out of a drawer almost as unexpectedly as in a fairy tale. But a command is an abstract idea, and it seemed a sort of lesser marvel till it flashed upon me that it involved the concrete existence of a ship. A ship. My ship. She was mine, more absolutely mine for possession and care than anything in the world, an object of responsibility and devotion. She was there, waiting for me, spellbound, unable to move, to live, to get out into the world, till I came, like an enchanted princess. Her call had come to me as if from the clouds. I had never suspected her existence. I didn't know how she looked. I had barely heard her name, and yet we were indissolubly united for a certain portion of our future, to sink or swim together. A sudden passion of anxious impatience rushed through my veins, gave me such a sense of the intensity of existence as I have never felt before or since. I discovered how much of a seaman I was, in heart, in mind, and, as it were, physically. A man exclusively of sea and ships. The sea, the only world that counted, and the ships, the test of manliness, of temperament, of courage and fidelity, and of love. I had an exquisite moment. It was unique also. Jumping up from my seat, I paced up and down my room for a long time. But when I came downstairs, I behaved with sufficient composure, only I couldn't eat anything at dinner. Having declared my intention not to drive but to walk down to the quay, I must render the wretched steward justice that he bestirred himself to find me some coolies for the luggage. They departed, carrying all my worldly possessions, except a little money I had in my pocket, slung from a long pole. Captain Giles volunteered to walk down with me. We followed the sombre, shaded alley across the esplanade. It was moderately cool there under the trees. Captain Giles remarked with a sudden laugh, "I know who's jolly thankful at having seen the last of you." I guessed that he meant the steward. The fellow had borne himself to me in a sulkily frightened manner at the last. I expressed my wonder that he should have tried to do me a bad turn for no reason at all. "Don't you see that what he wanted was to get rid of our friend Hamilton by dodging him in front of you for that job? That would have removed him for good, see?" "Heavens," I exclaimed, feeling humiliated somehow. "Can it be possible? What a fool he must be. That overbearing, impudent loafer? Why, he couldn't—" "And he's nearly done it, I believe, for the harbour office was bound to send somebody." "Aye, a fool like our steward can be dangerous sometimes," declared Captain Giles sententiously. "Just because he is a fool," he added, imparting further instruction in his complacent low tones. "For," he continued in the manner of a set demonstration, "no sensible person would risk being kicked out of the only berth between himself and starvation just to get rid of a simple annoyance, a small worry. Would he now?" "Well, no," I conceded, restraining a desire to laugh at that something mysteriously earnest in delivering the conclusions of his wisdom as though it were the product of prohibited operations. "But that fellow looks as if he were rather crazy. He must be." "As to that, I believe everybody in the world is a little mad," he announced quietly. "You make no exceptions?" I inquired, just to hear his manner. "Why, Kent says that even of you." "Does he?" I retorted, extremely embittered all at once against my former captain. "There's nothing of that in the written character from him which I've got in my pocket. Has he given you any instances of my lunacy?" Captain Giles explained in a conciliating tone that it had been only a friendly remark in reference to my abrupt leaving the ship for no apparent reason. I muttered grumpily, "Oh, leaving his ship," and mended my pace. He kept up by my side in the deep gloom of the avenue, as if it were his conscious duty to see me out of the colony as an undesirable character. He panted a little, which was rather pathetic in a way, but I was not moved. On the contrary, his discomfort gave me a sort of malicious pleasure. Presently I relented, slowed down, and said, "What I really wanted was to get a fresh grip. I felt it was time. Is that so very mad?" He made no answer. We were issuing from the avenue. On the bridge over the canal, a dark, irresolute figure seemed to be awaiting something or somebody. It was a Malay policeman, barefooted in his blue uniform. The silver band on his little round cap shone dimly in the light of the street lamp. He peered in our direction timidly. Before we could come up to him, he turned about and walked in front of us in the direction of the jetty. The distance was some 100 yards, and then I found my coolies squatting on their heels. They had kept the pole on their shoulders, and all my worldly goods, still tied to the pole, were resting on the ground between them. As far as the eye could reach along the quay, there was not another soul abroad except the police peon, who saluted us. It seems he had detained the coolies as suspicious characters, and had forbidden them the jetty. But at a sign from me, he took off the embargo with alacrity. The two patient fellows, rising together with a faint grunt, trotted off along the planks, and I prepared to take my leave of Captain Giles, who stood there with an air as though his mission were drawing to a close. It could not be denied that he had done it all. And while I hesitated about an appropriate sentence, he made himself heard. "I expect you'll have your hands pretty full of tangled-up business." I asked him what made him think so, and he answered that it was his general experience of the world. Ship a long time away from a port, owners inaccessible by cable, and the only man who could explain matters dead and buried. "And you yourself new to the business in a way," he concluded in a sort of unanswerable tone. "Don't insist," I said. "I know it only too well. I only wish you could impart to me some small portion of your experience before I go. As it can't be done in 10 minutes, I'd better not begin to ask you. There's that harbour launch waiting for me, too. But I won't feel really at peace till I have that ship of mine out in the Indian Ocean." He remarked casually that from Bangkok to the Indian Ocean was a pretty long step, and this murmur, like a dim flash from a dark lantern, showed me for a moment the broad belt of islands and reefs between that unknown ship which was mine and the freedom of the great waters of the globe. But I felt no apprehension. I was familiar enough with the archipelago by that time. Extreme patience and extreme care would see me through the region of broken land, of faint airs, and of dead water, to where I would feel at last my command swing on the great swell and list over to the great breath of regular winds that would give her the feeling of a large, more intense life. The road would be long. All roads are long that lead towards one's heart's desire. But this road my mind's eye could see on a chart, professionally, with all its complications and difficulties, yet simple enough in a way. One is a seaman, or one is not, and I had no doubt of being one. The only part I was a stranger to was the Gulf of Siam, and I mentioned this to Captain Giles. Not that I was concerned very much. It belonged to the same region, the nature of which I knew, into whose very soul I seemed to have looked during the last months of that existence with which I had broken now, as one parts with some enchanting company. "The Gulf, aye, a funny piece of water, that," said Captain Giles. Funny, in this connection, was a vague word. The whole thing sounded like an opinion uttered by a cautious person, mindful of actions for slander. I didn't inquire as to the nature of that funniness. There was really no time. But at the very last he volunteered a warning. "Whatever you do, keep to the east side of it. The west side is dangerous at this time of the year. Don't let anything tempt you over. You'll find nothing but trouble there." Though I could hardly imagine what could tempt me to involve my ship amongst the currents and reefs of the Malay shore, I thanked him for the advice. He gripped my extended arm warmly, and the end of our acquaintance came suddenly in the words, "Good night," That was all he said. Good night. Nothing more. I don't know what I intended to say, but surprise made me swallow it, whatever it was. I choked slightly, and then exclaimed with a sort of nervous haste, "Oh, good night, Captain Giles, good night." His movements were always deliberate, but his back had receded some distance along the deserted quay before I collected myself enough to follow his example and made a half-turn in the direction of the jetty. Only my movements were not deliberate. I hurried down to the steps and leapt into the launch. Before I had fairly landed in her stern sheets, the slim little craft darted away from the jetty with a sudden swirl of her propeller and the hard, rapid puffing of the exhaust in her vaguely gleaming brass funnel amidships. The misty churning at her stern was the only sound in the world. The shore lay plunged in the silence of the deeper slumber. I watched the town recede, still and soundless in the hot night, till the abrupt hail, "Steam launch ahoy!" made me spin round, face forward. We were close to a white, ghostly steamer. Lights shone on her decks, in her portholes, and the same voice shouted from her, "Is that our passenger?" "It is," I yelled. Her crew had been obviously on the jump. I could hear them running about. The modern spirit of haste was loudly vocal in the orders to heave away on the cable and to lower the side ladder, and in urgent requests to me to "Come along, sir. We have been delayed 3 hours for you. Our time is 7 o'clock, you know." I stepped on the deck. I said, "No, I don't know." The spirit of modern hurry was embodied in a thin, long-armed, long-legged man with a closely clipped grey beard. His meagre hand was hot and dry. He declared feverishly, "I'm hanged if I would have waited another 5 minutes, harbour master or no harbour master." "That's your own business," I said. "I didn't ask you to wait for me." "I hope you don't expect any supper," he burst out. "This isn't a boarding house afloat. You're the first passenger I ever had in my life, and I hope to goodness you'll be the last." I made no answer to this hospitable communication, and indeed he didn't wait for any, bolting away onto his bridge to get his ship under way. The 3 days he had me on board he did not depart from that half-hostile attitude. His ship having been delayed 3 hours on my account, he couldn't forgive me for not being a more distinguished person. He was not exactly outspoken about it, but that feeling of annoyed wonder was peeping out perpetually in his talk. He was absurd. He was also a man of much experience, which he liked to trot out, but no greater contrast with Captain Giles could have been imagined. He would have amused me if I had wanted to be amused, but I did not want to be amused. I was like a lover looking forward to a meeting. Human hostility was nothing to me. I thought of my unknown ship. It was amusement enough, torment enough, occupation enough. He perceived my state, for his wits were sufficiently sharp for that, and he poked sly fun at my preoccupation in the manner some nasty, cynical old men assume towards the dreams and illusions of youth. I, on my side, refrained from questioning him as to the appearance of my ship, though I knew that being in Bangkok every fortnight or so, he must have known her by sight. I was not going to expose the ship, my ship, to some slighting reference. He was the first really unsympathetic man I had ever come in contact with. My education was far from being finished, though I didn't know it. No, I didn't know it. All I knew was that he disliked me and had some contempt for my person. Why? Apparently because his ship had been delayed 3 hours on my account. Who was I to have such a thing done for me? Such a thing had never been done for him. It was a sort of jealous indignation. My expectation, mingled with fear, was wrought to its highest pitch. How slow had been the days of the passage, and how soon they were over. One morning, early, we crossed the bar, and while the sun was rising splendidly over the flat spaces of the land, we steamed up the innumerable bends, passed under the shadow of the great gilt pagoda, and reached the outskirts of the town. There it was, spread largely on both banks, the Oriental capital which had as yet suffered no white conqueror, an expanse of brown houses of bamboo, of mats, of leaves, of a vegetable matter style of architecture, sprung out of the brown soil on the banks of the muddy river. It was amazing to think that in those miles of human habitations there was not probably half a dozen pounds of nails. Some of those houses of sticks and grass, like the nests of an aquatic race, clung to the low shores. Others seemed to grow out of the water. Others again floated in long, anchored rows in the very middle of the stream. Here and there in the distance, above the crowded mob of low, brown roof ridges, towered great piles of masonry, king's palace, temples, gorgeous and dilapidated, crumbling under the vertical sunlight, tremendous, overpowering, almost palpable, which seemed to enter one's breast with the breath of one's nostrils and soak into one's limbs through every pore of one's skin. The ridiculous victim of jealousy had for some reason or other to stop his engines just then. The steamer drifted slowly up with the tide. Oblivious of my new surroundings, I walked the deck in anxious, deadened abstraction, a commingling of romantic reverie with a very practical survey of my qualifications. For the time was approaching for me to behold my command and to prove my worth in the ultimate test of my profession. Suddenly I heard myself called by that imbecile. He was beckoning me to come up on his bridge. I didn't care very much for that, but as it seemed that he had something particular to say, I went up the ladder. He laid his hand on my shoulder and gave me a slight turn, pointing with his other arm at the same time. "There, that's your ship, Captain," he said. I felt a thump in my breast, only one, as if my heart had then ceased to beat. There were 10 or more ships moored along the bank, and the one he meant was partly hidden away from my sight by her next astern. He said, "We'll drift abreast her in a moment." What was his tone? Mocking, threatening, or only indifferent? I could not tell. I suspected some malice in this unexpected manifestation of interest. He left me, and I leant over the rail of the bridge, looking over the side. I dared not raise my eyes. Yet it had to be done, and indeed I could not have helped myself. I believe I trembled. But directly my eyes had rested on my ship, all my fear vanished. It went off swiftly like a bad dream, only that a dream leaves no shame behind it, and that I felt a momentary shame at my unworthy suspicions. Yes, there she was. Her hull, her rigging, filled my eye with a great content. That feeling of life-emptiness which had made me so restless for the last few months lost its bitter plausibility, its evil influence, dissolved in a flow of joyous emotion. At first glance I saw that she was a high-class vessel, a harmonious creature in the lines of her fine body, in the proportioned tallness of her spars. Whatever her age and her history, she had preserved the stamp of her origin. She was one of those craft that, in virtue of their design and complete finish, will never look old. Amongst her companions moored to the bank, and all bigger than herself, she looked like a creature of high breed, an Arab steed in a string of cart horses. A voice behind me said, in a nasty, equivocal tone, "I hope you are satisfied with her, Captain." I did not even turn my head. It was the master of the steamer, and whatever he meant, whatever he thought of her, I knew that, like some rare women, she was one of those creatures whose mere existence is enough to waken an unselfish delight. One feels that it is good to be in the world in which she has her being. That illusion of life and character which charms one in men's finest handiwork radiated from her. An enormous bulk of teakwood timber swung over her hatchway, lifeless matter, looking heavier and bigger than anything aboard of her. When they started lowering it, the surge of the tackle sent a quiver through her, from waterline to the trucks up the fine nerves of her rigging, as though she had shuddered at the weight. It seemed cruel to load her so. Half an hour later, putting my foot on her deck for the first time, I received the feeling of deep physical satisfaction. Nothing could equal the fullness of that moment, the ideal completeness of that emotional experience which had come to me without the preliminary toil and disenchantments of an obscure career. My rapid glance ran over her, enveloped, appropriated the form concreting the abstract sentiment of my command. A lot of details perceptible to a seaman struck my eye vividly in that instant. For the rest, I saw her disengaged from the material conditions of her being. The shore to which she was moored was as if it did not exist. What were to me all the countries of the globe? In all the parts of the world washed by navigable waters, our relation to each other would be the same, and more intimate than there are words to express in the language. Apart from that, every scene and episode would be a mere passing show. The very gang of yellow coolies busy about the main hatch was less substantial than the stuff dreams are made of. For who on earth would dream of Chinamen? I went aft, ascended the poop, where, under the awning, gleamed the brasses of the yacht-like fittings, the polished surfaces of the rails, the glass of the skylights. Right aft, two seamen, busy cleaning the steering gear with the reflected ripples of light running playfully up their bent backs, went on with their work, unaware of me and of the almost affectionate glance I threw at them in passing towards the companionway of the cabin. The door stood wide open. The slide was pushed right back. The half-turn of the staircase cut off the view of the lobby. A low humming ascended from below, but it stopped abruptly at the sound of my descending footsteps. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of The Shadow Line by Joseph Conrad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. The Shadow Line, Chapter 3. The first thing I saw down there was the upper part of a man's body projecting backward, as it were, from one of the doors at the foot of the stairs. His eyes looked at me very wide and still. In one hand he held a dinner plate, in the other a cloth. "I am your new captain," I said quietly. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, he had got rid of the plate and the cloth and jumped to open the cabin door. As soon as I passed into the saloon, he vanished, but only to reappear instantly, buttoning up a jacket he had put on with the swiftness of a quick-change artist. "Where's the chief mate?" I asked. "In the hold, I think, sir. I saw him go down the after-hatch 10 minutes ago." "Tell him I'm on board." The mahogany table under the skylight shone in the twilight like a dark pool of water. The sideboard, surmounted by a wide looking-glass in an ormolu frame, had a marble top. It bore a pair of silver-plated lamps and some other pieces, obviously a harbour display. The saloon itself was panelled in two kinds of wood, in the excellent simple taste prevailing when the ship was built. I sat down in the armchair at the head of the table, the captain's chair, with a small tell-tale compass swung above it, a mute reminder of unremitting vigilance. A succession of men had sat in that chair. I became aware of that thought suddenly, vividly, as though each had left a little of himself between the four walls of these ornate bulkheads, as if a sort of composite soul, the soul of command, had whispered suddenly to mine of long days at sea and of anxious moments. "You too," it seemed to say, "you too shall taste of that peace and that unrest in a searching intimacy with your own self, obscure, as it were, and as supreme in the face of all the winds and all the seas, in an immensity that receives no impress, preserves no memories, and keeps no reckoning of lives." Deep within the tarnished ormolu frame, in the hot half-light sifted through the awning, I saw my own face propped between my hands, and I stared back at myself with the perfect detachment of distance, rather with curiosity than with any other feeling, except of some sympathy for this latest representative of what, for all intents and purposes, was a dynasty, continuous not in blood indeed, but in its experience, in its training, in its conception of duty, and in the blessed simplicity of its traditional point of view on life. It struck me that this quietly staring man whom I was watching, both as if he were myself and somebody else, was not exactly a lonely figure. He had his place in a line of men whom he did not know, of whom he had never heard, but who were fashioned by the same influences, whose souls, in relation to their humble life's work, had no secrets for him. Suddenly I perceived that there was another man in the saloon, standing a little on one side and looking intently at me, the chief mate. His long red moustache determined the character of his physiognomy, which struck me as pugnacious in, strange to say, a ghastly sort of way. How long had he been there looking at me, appraising me in my unguarded, daydreaming state? I would have been more disconcerted if, having the clock set in the top of the mirror frame right in front of me, I had not noticed that its long hand had hardly moved at all. I could not have been in that cabin more than 2 minutes altogether. Say three. so he could not have been watching me more than a mere fraction of a minute, luckily. Still, I regretted the occurrence. But I showed nothing of it as I rose leisurely, it had to be leisurely, and granted him with perfect friendliness. There was something reluctant and at the same time attentive in his bearing. His name was Burns. We left the cabin and went round the ship together. His face, in the full light of day, appeared very pale, meagre, even haggard. Somehow I had a delicacy in looking too often at him. His eyes, on the contrary, remained fairly glued on my face. They were greenish and had an expectant expression. He answered all my questions readily enough, but my ear seemed to catch a tone of unwillingness. The second officer, with three or four hands, was busy forward. The mate mentioned his name, and I nodded to him in passing. He was very young. He struck me as rather a cub. When we returned below, I sat down on one end of a deep semicircular, or rather semi-oval, settee, upholstered in red plush. It extended right across the whole after end of the cabin. Mr. Byrne motioned to sit down, dropped into one of the swivel chairs round the table, and kept his eyes on me as persistently as ever, and with that strange air as if all this were make-believe, and he expected me to get up, burst into a laugh, slap him on the back, and vanish from the cabin. There was an odd stress in the situation which began to make me uncomfortable. I tried to react against this vague feeling. "It's only my inexperience," I thought. In the face of that man, several years, I judged, older than myself, I became aware of what I had left already behind me, my youth. And that was indeed poor comfort. Youth is a fine thing, a mighty power, as long as one does not think of it. I felt I was becoming self-conscious. Almost against my will, I assumed a moody gravity. I said, "I see you have kept her in very good order, Mr. Burns." Directly I had uttered these words, I asked myself angrily, why the deuce did I want to say that? Mr. Burns, in answer, had only blinked at me. What on earth did he mean? I fell back on a question which had been in my thoughts for a long time, the most natural question on the lips of any seaman whatever joining a ship. I voiced it, confound this self-consciousness, in a degaged, cheerful tone. "I suppose she can travel, what?" Now, a question like this might have been answered normally, either in accents of apologetic sorrow, or with a visibly suppressed pride, in a "I don't want to boast, but you shall see" sort of tone. There are sailors, too, who would have been roughly outspoken, "Lazy brute," or openly delighted, "She's a flyer." Two ways, if four manners. But Mr. Burns found another way, a way of his own, which had at all events the merit of saving his breath, if no other. Again, he did not say anything. He only frowned, and it was an angry frown. I waited. Nothing more came. "What's the matter? Can't you tell after being nearly 2 years in the ship?" I addressed him sharply. He looked as startled for a moment as though he had discovered my presence only that very moment. But this passed off almost at once. He put on an air of indifference, but I suppose he thought it better to say something. He said that a ship needed, just like a man, the chance to show the best she could do, and that this ship had never had a chance since he had been on board of her. Not that he could remember. The last captain. He paused. "Has he been so very unlucky?" I asked with frank incredulity. Mr. Burns turned his eyes away from me. "No, the late captain was not an unlucky man. One couldn't say that. But he had not seemed to want to make use of his luck." Mr. Burns, man of enigmatic moods, made this statement with an inanimate face and staring wilfully at the rudder casing. The statement itself was obscurely suggestive. I asked quietly, "Where did he die?" "In the saloon, just where you are sitting now," answered Mr. Burns. I repressed a silly impulse to jump up, but upon the whole I was relieved to hear that he had not died in the bed which was now to be mine. I pointed out to the chief mate that what I really wanted to know was where he had buried his late captain. Mr. Burns said it was at the entrance to the gulf, a roomy grave. A sufficient answer. But the mate, overcoming visibly something within him, something like a curious reluctance to believe in my advent, as an irrevocable fact at any rate, did not stop at that, though indeed he may have wished to do so. As a compromise with his feelings, I believe, he addressed himself persistently to the rudder casing, so that to me he had the appearance of a man talking in solitude, a little unconsciously, however. His tale was that at 7 bells in the forenoon watch he had all hands mustered on the quarter-deck and told them they had better go down to say good-bye to the captain. Those words, as if grudged to an intruding personage, were enough for me to evoke vividly that strange ceremony. The barefooted, bare-headed seamen crowding shyly into that cabin, a small mob pressed against that sideboard, uncomfortable rather than moved, shirts open on sunburnt chests, weather-beaten faces, and all staring at the dying man with the same grave and expectant expression. "Was he conscious?" I asked. "He didn't speak, but he moved his eyes to look at them," said the mate. After waiting a moment, Mr. Burns motioned the crew to leave the cabin, but he detained the two eldest men to stay with the captain while he went on deck with his sextant to take the sun. It was getting towards noon, and he was anxious to obtain a good observation for latitude. When he returned below to put his sextant away, he found that the two men had retreated out into the lobby. Through the open door he had a view of the captain lying easy against the pillows. He had passed away while Mr. Burns was taking his observation, as near as noon as possible. He had hardly changed his position. Mr. Burns sighed, glanced at me inquisitively, as much as to say, "Aren't you going yet?" and then turned his thoughts from his new captain back to the old, who, being dead, had no authority, was not in anybody's way, and was much easier to deal with. Mr. Burns dealt with him at some length. He was a peculiar man, of 65 about, iron-grey, hard-faced, obstinate, and uncommunicative. He used to keep the ship loafing at sea for inscrutable reasons. Would come on deck at night sometimes, take some sail off her, God only knows why or wherefore, then go below, shut himself up in his cabin, and play on the violin for hours, till daybreak, perhaps. In fact, he spent most of his time, day or night, playing the violin. That was when the fit took him. Very loud, too. It came to this, that Mr. Burns mustered his courage one day and remonstrated earnestly with the captain. Neither he nor the second mate could get a wink of sleep in their watches below for the noise, and how could they be expected to keep awake while on duty? He pleaded. The answer of that stern man was that if he and the second mate didn't like the noise, they were welcome to pack up their traps and walk over the side. When this alternative was offered, the ship happened to be 600 miles from the nearest land. Mr. Burns at this point looked at me with an air of curiosity. I began to think that my predecessor was a remarkably peculiar old man. But I had to hear stranger things yet. It came out that this stern, grim, wind-tanned, rough, sea-salted, taciturn sailor of 65 was not only an artist, but a lover as well. In Haiphong, when they got there after a course of most unprofitable peregrinations, during which the ship was nearly lost twice, he got himself, in Mr. Burns' own words, mixed up with some woman. Mr. Burns had had no personal knowledge of that affair, but positive evidence of it existed in the shape of a photograph taken in Haiphong. Mr. Burns found it in one of the drawers in the captain's room. In due course, I too saw that amazing document. I even threw it overboard later. There he sat, with his hands reposing on his knees, bald, squat, grey, bristly, recalling a wild boar somehow, and by his side towered an awful, mature, white female with rapacious nostrils and a cheaply ill-omened stare in her enormous eyes. She was disguised in some semi-oriental, vulgar, fancy costume. She resembled a low-class medium, or one of those women who tell fortunes by cards for half a crown. And yet she was striking, a professional sorceress from the slums. It was incomprehensible. There was something awful in the thought that she was the last reflection of the world of passion for the fierce soul which seemed to look at one out of the sardonically savage face of that old seaman. However, I noticed that she was holding some musical instrument, guitar or mandolin, in her hand. Perhaps that was the secret of her sortilege. For Mr. Burns, that photograph explained why the unloaded ship had kept sweltering at anchor for 3 weeks in a pestilential hot harbour without air. They lay there and gasped. The captain, appearing now and then on short visits, mumbled to Mr. Burns unlikely tales about some letters he was waiting for. Suddenly, after vanishing for a week, he came on board in the middle of the night and took the ship out to sea with the first break of dawn. Daylight showed him looking wild and ill. The mere getting clear of the land took 2 days, and somehow or other they bumped slightly on a reef. However, no leak developed, and the captain, growling, "No matter," informed Mr. Burns that he had made up his mind to take the ship to Hong Kong and dry dock her there. At this, Mr. Burns was plunged into despair, for indeed, to beat up to Hong Kong against a fierce monsoon, with a ship not sufficiently ballasted and with her supply of water not completed, was an insane project. But the captain growled peremptorily, "Stick her at it," and Mr. Burns, dismayed and enraged, stuck her at it and kept her at it, blowing away sails, straining the spars, exhausting the crew, nearly maddened by the absolute conviction that the attempt was impossible and was bound to end in some catastrophe. Meantime the captain, shut up in his cabin and wedged in a corner of his settee against the crazy bounding of the ship, played the violin, or at any rate made continuous noise on it. When he appeared on deck he would not speak, and not always answer when spoken to. It was obvious that he was ill in some mysterious manner, and beginning to break up. As the days went by, the sounds of the violin became less and less loud, till at last only a feeble scratching would meet Mr. Burns' ear as he stood in the saloon listening outside the door of the captain's stateroom. One afternoon, in perfect desperation, he burst into that room and made such a scene, tearing his hair and shouting such horrible imprecations, that he cowed the contemptuous spirit of the sick man. The water tanks were low. They had not gained 50 miles in a fortnight. She would never reach Hong Kong. It was like fighting desperately towards destruction for the ship and the men. This was evident without argument. Mr. Burns, losing all restraint, put his face close to the captain's and fairly yelled, "You, sir, are going out of the world, but I can't wait till you are dead before I put the helm up. You must do it yourself. You must do it now." The man on the couch snarled in contempt, "So I am going out of the world, am I?" "Yes, sir, you haven't many days left in it," said Mr. Burns, calming down. "One can see it by your face." "My face, eh? Well, put up the helm, and be damned to you." Burns flew on deck, got the ship before the wind, then came down again, composed, but resolute. "I've shaped a course for Pulo Condor, sir," he said. "When we make it, if you are still with us, you'll tell me into what port you wish me to take the ship, and I'll do it." The old man gave him a look of savage spite, and said those atrocious words in deadly slow tones. "If I had my wish, neither the ship nor any of you would ever reach a port, and I hope you won't." Mr. Burns was profoundly shocked. I believe he was positively frightened at the time. It seems, however, that he managed to produce such an effective laugh that it was the old man's turn to be frightened. He shrank within himself and turned his back on him. "And his head was not gone then," Mr. Burns assured me excitedly. "He meant every word of it." Such was practically the late captain's last speech. No connected sentence passed his lips afterwards. That night he used the last of his strength to throw his fiddle over the side. No one had actually seen him in the act, but after his death Mr. Burns couldn't find the thing anywhere. The empty case was very much in evidence, but the fiddle was clearly not in the ship. And where else could it have gone to but overboard? "Threw his violin overboard," I exclaimed. "He did," cried Mr. Burns excitedly. "And it's my belief he would have tried to take the ship down with him if it had been in human power. He never meant her to see home again. He wouldn't write to his owners. He never wrote to his old wife, either. He wasn't going to. He had made up his mind to cut adrift from everything. That's what it was. He didn't care for business or freights or for making a passage or anything. He meant to have gone wandering about the world till he lost her with all hands." Mr. Burns looked like a man who had escaped great danger. For a little he would have exclaimed, "If it hadn't been for me!" And the transparent innocence of his indignant eyes was underlined quaintly by the arrogant pair of moustaches which he proceeded to twist and as if extend horizontally. I might have smiled if I had not been busy with my own sensations, which were not those of Mr. Burns. I was already the man in command. My sensations could not be like those of any other man on board. In that community I stood like a king in his country, in a class all by myself. I mean an hereditary king, not a mere elected head of a state. I was brought there to rule by an agency as remote from the people and as inscrutable almost to them as the grace of God. And, like a member of a dynasty feeling a semi-mystical bond with the dead, I was profoundly shocked by my immediate predecessor. That man had been, in all essentials but his age, just such another man as myself. He at the end of his life was a complete act of treason, the betrayal of a tradition which seemed to me as imperative as any guide on earth could be. It appeared that even at sea a man could become the victim of evil spirits. I felt on my face the breath of unknown powers that shape our destinies. Not to let the silence last too long, I asked Mr. Burns if he had written to his captain's wife. He shook his head. He had written to nobody. In a moment he became sombre. He never thought of writing. It took him all his time to watch incessantly the loading of the ship by a rascally Chinese stevedore. In this, Mr. Burns gave me the first glimpse of the real chief mate's soul, which dwelt uneasily in his body. He mused, then hastened on with gloomy force. Yes, the captain died as near noon as possible. I looked through his papers in the afternoon. I read the service over him at sunset, and then I stuck the ship's head north and brought her in here. I brought her in. He struck the table with his fist. She would hardly have come in by herself, I observed. But why didn't you make for Singapore instead? His eyes wavered. The nearest port, he muttered sullenly. I had framed the question in perfect innocence, but his answer, the difference in distance was insignificant, and his manner offered me a clue to the simple truth. He took the ship to a port where he expected to be confirmed in his temporary command from lack of a qualified master to put over his head. Whereas Singapore, he surmised justly, would be full of qualified men. But his naive reasoning forgot to take into account the telegraph cable reposing on the bottom of the very gulf up which he had turned that ship which he imagined himself to have saved from destruction. Hence the bitter flavour of our interview. I tasted it more and more distinctly, and it was less and less to my taste. "Look here, Mr. Burns," I began very firmly. "You may as well understand that I did not run after this command. It was pushed in my way. I've accepted it. I'm here to take the ship home, first of all, and you may be sure that I shall see to it that every one of you on board here does his duty to that end. That is all I have to say for the present." He was on his feet by this time, but instead of taking his dismissal, he remained with trembling, indignant lips, and looked at me hard, as though, really, after this, there was nothing for me to do in common decency but to vanish from his outraged sight. Like all very simple emotional states, this was moving. I felt sorry for him, almost sympathetic, till, seeing that I did not vanish, he spoke in a tone of forced restraint. "If I hadn't a wife and child at home, you may be sure, sir, I would have asked you to let me go the very minute you came on board." I answered him with a matter-of-fact calmness, as though some remote third person were in question. "And I, Mr. Burns, would not have let you go. You have signed the ship's articles as chief officer until they are terminated at the final port of discharge. I shall expect you to attend to your duty, and give me the benefit of your experience to the best of your ability." Stony incredulity lingered in his eyes, but it broke down before my friendly attitude. With a slight upward toss of his arms, I got to know that gesture well afterwards, he bolted out of the cabin. We might have saved ourselves that little passage of harmless sparring. Before many days had elapsed, it was Mr. Burns who was pleading with me anxiously not to leave him behind, while I could only return him but doubtful answers. The whole thing took on a somewhat tragic complexion. And this horrible problem was only an extraneous episode, a mere complication in the general problem of how to get that ship, which was mine, with her appurtenances and her men, with her body and her spirit now slumbering in that pestilential river, how to get her out to sea. Mr. Burns, while still acting captain, had hastened to sign a charter party, which in an ideal world without guile would have been an excellent document. Directly I ran my eye over it, I foresaw trouble ahead, unless the people of the other part were quite exceptionally fair-minded and open to argument. Mr. Burns, to whom I imparted my fears, chose to take great umbrage at them. He looked at me with that usual incredulous stare and said bitterly, "I suppose, sir, you want to make out I've acted like a fool." I told him, with my systematic kindliness, which always seemed to augment his surprise, that I did not want to make out anything. I would leave that to the future. And sure enough, the future brought in a lot of trouble. There were days when I used to remember Captain Giles with nothing short of abhorrence. His confounded acuteness had let me in for this job, while his prophecy that I would have my hands full coming true made it appear as if done on purpose to play an evil joke on my young innocence. Yes, I had my hands full of complications, which were most valuable as experience. People have a great opinion of the advantages of experience. But in this connection, experience means always something disagreeable, as opposed to the charm and innocence of illusions. I must say I was losing mine rapidly. But on these instructive complications, I must not enlarge more than to say they could all be resumed in the one word, delay. A mankind which has invented the proverb, "Time is money," will understand my vexation. The word delay entered the secret chamber of my brain, resounded there like a tolling bell which maddens the ear, affected all my senses, took on a black colouring, a bitter taste, a deadly meaning. "I am really sorry to see you worried like this. Indeed I am." It was the only humane speech I used to hear at that time, and it came from a doctor, appropriately enough. A doctor is humane by definition, but that man was so in reality. His speech was not professional. I was not ill, but other people were, and that was the reason for his visiting the ship. He was the doctor of our legation, and, of course, of the consulate, too. He looked after the ship's health, which generally was poor and trembling, as it were, on the verge of a break-up. Yes, the men ailed, and thus time was not only money, but life as well. I had never seen such a steady ship's company. As the doctor remarked to me, "You seem to have a most respectable lot of seamen." Not only were they consistently sober, but they did not even want to go ashore. Care was taken to expose them as little as possible to the sun. They were employed on light work under the awnings, and the humane doctor commended me. "Your arrangements appear to me to be very judicious, my dear captain." It is difficult to express how much that pronouncement comforted me. The doctor's round, full face, framed in a light-coloured whisker, was the perfection of a dignified amenity. He was the only human being in the world who seemed to take the slightest interest in me. He would generally sit in the cabin for half an hour or so at every visit. I said to him one day, "I suppose the only thing now is to take care of them as you are doing till I can get the ship to sea." He inclined his head, shutting his eyes under large spectacles, and murmured, "The sea, undoubtedly." The first member of the crew fairly knocked over was the steward, the first man to whom I had spoken on board. He was taken ashore with choleric symptoms and died there at the end of a week. Then, while I was still under the startling impression of this first home thrust of the climate, Mr. Burns gave up and went to bed in a raging fever without saying a word to anybody. I believe he had partly fretted himself into that illness. The climate did the rest with the swiftness of an invisible monster ambushed in the air, in the water, in the mud of the river bank. Mr. Burns was a predestined victim. I discovered him lying on his back, glaring sullenly and radiating heat on one like a small furnace. He would hardly answer my questions and only grumbled. "Couldn't a man take an afternoon off duty with a bad headache, for once?" That evening, as I sat in the saloon after dinner, I could hear him muttering continuously in his room. Ransom, who was clearing the table, said to me, "I'm afraid, sir, I won't be able to give the mate all the attention he's likely to need. I will have to be forward in the galley a great part of my time." Ransom was the cook. The mate had pointed him out to me the first day, standing on the deck, his arms crossed on his broad chest, gazing on the river. Even at a distance, his well-proportioned figure, something thoroughly sailor-like in his poise, made him noticeable. On nearer view, the intelligent, quiet eyes, a well-bred face, the disciplined independence of his manner made up an attractive personality. When, in addition, Mr. Burns told me that he was the best seaman in the ship, I expressed my surprise that in his earliest prime and of such appearance he should sign on as cook on board a ship. "It's his heart," Mr. Burns had said. "There's something wrong with it. He mustn't exert himself too much, or he may drop dead suddenly." And he was the only one the climate had not touched, perhaps because, carrying a deadly enemy in his breast, he had schooled himself into a systematic control of feelings and movements. When one was in the secret, this was apparent in his manner. After the poor steward died, and as he could not be replaced by a white man in this oriental port, Ransom had volunteered to do the double work. "I can do it all right, sir, as long as I go about it quietly," he had assured me. But obviously he couldn't be expected to take up sick nursing in addition. Moreover, the doctor peremptorily ordered Mr. Burns ashore. With a seaman on each side holding him up under the arms, the mate went over the gangway more sullen than ever. We built him up with pillows in the gharry, and he made an effort to say brokenly, "Now you've got what you wanted. Got me out of the ship." "You were never more mistaken in your life, Mr. Burns," I said quietly, duly smiling at him, and the trap drove off to a sort of sanatorium, a pavilion of bricks which the doctor had in the grounds of his residence. I visited Mr. Burns regularly. After the first few days, when he didn't know anybody, he received me as if I had come either to gloat over an enemy or else to curry favour with a deeply wronged person. It was either one or the other, just as it happened according to his fantastic sick-room moods. Whichever it was, he managed to convey it to me even during the period when he appeared almost too weak to talk. I treated him to my invariable kindliness. Then, one day, suddenly, a surge of downright panic burst through all this craziness. If I left him behind in this deadly place, he would die. He felt it, he was certain of it. But I wouldn't have the heart to leave him ashore. He had a wife and child in Sydney. He produced his wasted forearms from under the sheet which covered him, and clasped his fleshless claws. He would die! He would die! Here! He absolutely managed to sit up, but only for a moment, and when he fell back I really thought that he would die there and then. I called to the Bengali dispenser and hastened away from the room. Next day he upset me thoroughly by renewing his entreaties. I returned an evasive answer, and left him the picture of ghastly despair. The day after I went in with reluctance, and he attacked me at once in a much stronger voice and with an abundance of argument which was quite startling. He presented his case with a sort of crazy vigour, and asked me finally how would I like to have a man's death on my conscience. He wanted me to promise that I would not sail without him. I said that I really must consult the doctor first. He cried out at that, "The doctor! Never! That would be a death sentence." The effort had exhausted him. He closed his eyes, but went on rambling in a low voice. I had hated him from the start. The late captain had hated him too, had wished him dead, had wished all hands dead. "What do you want to stand in with that wicked corpse for, sir? He'll have you too," he ended, blinking his glazed eyes vacantly. "Mr. Burns," I cried, very much discomposed, "what on earth are you talking about?" He seemed to come to himself, though he was too weak to start. "I don't know," he said languidly. "But don't ask that doctor, sir. You and I are sailors. Don't ask him, sir. Some day perhaps you will have a wife and child yourself." And again he pleaded for the promise that I would not leave him behind. I had the firmness of mind not to give it to him. Afterward this sternness seemed criminal, for my mind was made up. That prostrated man, with hardly strength enough to breathe and ravaged by a passion of fear, was irresistible. And besides, he had happened to hit on the right words. He and I were sailors. That was a claim, for I had no other family. As to the wife and child some day argument, it had no force. It sounded merely bizarre. I could imagine no claim that would be stronger and more absorbing than the claim of that ship, of these men snared in the river by silly commercial complications, as if in some poisonous trap. However, I had nearly fought my way out to sea. The sea which was pure, safe, and friendly. 3 days more. That thought sustained and carried me on my way back to the ship. In the saloon the doctor's voice greeted me, and his large form followed his voice, issuing out of the starboard spare cabin where the ship's medicine chest was kept securely lashed in the bed place. Finding that I was not on board, he had gone in there, he said, to inspect the supply of drugs, bandages, and so on. Everything was completed and in order. I thanked him. I had just been thinking of asking him to do that very thing, as in a couple of days, as he knew, we were going to sea, where all our troubles of every sort would be over at last. He listened gravely and made no answer. But when I opened to him my mind as to Mr. Burns, he sat down by my side, and laying his hand on my knee amicably, begged me to think what it was I was exposing myself to. The man was just strong enough to bear being moved, and no more, but he couldn't stand a return of the fever. I had before me a passage of 60 days, perhaps, beginning with intricate navigation, and ending probably with a lot of bad weather. Could I run the risk of having to go through it single-handed, with no chief officer, and with a second, quite a youth? He might have added that it was my first command, too. He probably did think of that fact, for he checked himself. It was very present to my mind. He advised me earnestly to cable to Singapore for a chief officer, even if I had to delay my sailing for a week. Never, I said. The very thought gave me the shivers. The hands seemed fairly fit, all of them, and this was the time to get them away. Once at sea, I was not afraid of facing anything. The sea was now the only remedy for all my troubles. The doctor's glasses were directed at me like two lamps, searching the genuineness of my resolution. He opened his lips as if to argue further, but shut them again without saying anything. I had a vision so vivid of poor Burns in his exhaustion, helplessness, and anguish that it moved me more than the reality I had come away from only an hour before. I was purged from the drawbacks of his personality, and I could not resist it. "Look here," I said. "Unless you tell me officially that the man must not be moved, I'll make arrangements to have him brought on board tomorrow, and shall take the ship out of the river next morning, even if I have to anchor outside the bar for a couple of days to get her ready for sea." "Oh, I'll make all the arrangements myself," said the doctor at once. "I spoke as I did, only as a friend, as a well-wisher, and that sort of thing." He rose in his dignified simplicity and gave me a warm handshake, rather solemnly, I thought. But he was as good as his word. When Mr. Burns appeared at the gangway, carried on a stretcher, the doctor himself walked by its side. The programme had been altered in so far that this transportation had been left to the last moment, on the very morning of our departure. It was barely an hour after sunrise. The doctor waved his big arm to me from the shore and walked back at once to his trap, which had followed him empty to the riverside. Mr. Burns, carried across the quarter-deck, had the appearance of being absolutely lifeless. Ransom went down to settle him in his cabin. I had to remain on deck to look after the ship, for the tug had got hold of our tow-rope already. The splash of our shore-fasts falling in the water produced a complete change of feeling in me. It was like the imperfect relief of awakening from a nightmare. But when the ship's head swung down the river, away from that town, oriental and squalid, I missed the expected elation of that striven-for moment. What there was, undoubtedly, was a relaxation of tension, which translated itself into a sense of weariness after an inglorious fight. About midday, we anchored a mile outside the bar. The afternoon was busy for all hands. Watching the work from the poop, where I remained all the time, I detected in it some of the languor of the 6 weeks spent in the steaming heat of the river. The first breeze would blow that away. Now the calm was complete. I judged that the second officer, a callow youth with an unpromising face, was not, to put it mildly, of that invaluable stuff from which a commander's right hand is made. But I was glad to catch, along the main deck, a few smiles on those seamen's faces, at which I had hardly had time to have a good look as yet. Having thrown off the mortal coil of shore affairs, I felt myself familiar with them, and yet a little strange, like a long-lost wanderer among his kin. Ransom flitted continually to and fro between the galley and the cabin. It was a pleasure to look at him. The man positively had grace. He alone of all the crew had not had a day's illness in port. But with the knowledge of that uneasy heart within his breast, I could detect the restraint he put on the natural sailor-like agility of his movements. It was as though he had something very fragile or very explosive to carry about his person, and was all the time aware of it. I had occasion to address him once or twice. He answered me in his pleasant, quiet voice, and with a faint, slightly wistful smile. Mr. Burns appeared to be resting. He seemed fairly comfortable. After sunset, I came out on deck again to meet only a stiff void. The thin, featureless crust of the coast could not be distinguished. The darkness had risen around the ship like a mysterious emanation from the dumb and lonely waters. I leant on the rail and turned my ear to the shadows of the night. Not a sound. My command might have been a planet flying vertiginously on its appointed path in a space of infinite silence. I clung to the rail as if my sense of balance were leaving me for good. How absurd! I called nervously, "On deck there!" The immediate answer, "Yes, sir," broke the spell. The anchor watch man ran up the poop ladder smartly. I told him to report at once the slightest sign of a breeze coming. Going below, I looked in on Mr. Burns. In fact, I could not avoid seeing him, for his door stood open. The man was so wasted that, in this white cabin, under a white sheet, and with his diminished head sunk in the white pillow, his red moustaches captured their eyes exclusively, like something artificial, a pair of moustaches from a shop exhibited there in the harsh light of the bulkhead lamp without a shade. While I stared with a sort of wonder, he asserted himself by opening his eyes and even moving them in my direction. A minute stir. "Dead calm, Mr. Burns," I said resignedly. In an unexpectedly distinct voice, Mr. Burns began a rambling speech. Its tone was very strange, not as if affected by his illness, but as if of a different nature. It sounded unearthly. As to the matter, I seemed to make out that it was the fault of the old man, the late captain, ambushed down there under the sea with some evil intention. It was a weird story. I listened to the end. Then, stepping into the cabin, I laid my hand on the mate's forehead. It was cool. He was light-headed only from extreme weakness. Suddenly he seemed to become aware of me, and in his own voice, of course very feeble, he asked regretfully, "Is there no chance at all to get under way, sir?" "What's the good of letting go our hold of the ground only to drift, Mr. Burns?" I answered. He sighed, and I left him to his immobility. His hold on life was as slender as his hold on sanity. I was oppressed by my lonely responsibilities. I went into my cabin to seek relief in a few hours' sleep, but almost before I closed my eyes the man on deck came down reporting a light breeze. "Enough to get under way with," he said. And it was no more than just enough. I ordered the windlass manned, the sails loosed, and the topsails set. But by the time I had cast the ship, I could hardly feel any breath of wind. Nevertheless, I trimmed the yards and put everything on her. I was not going to give up the attempt. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of The Shadow Line by Joseph Conrad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. The Shadow Line, Chapter 4. With her anchor at the bow, and clothed in canvas to her very trucks, my command seemed to stand as motionless as a model ship set on the gleams and shadows of polished marble. It was impossible to distinguish land from water in the enigmatical tranquillity of the immense forces of the world. A sudden impatience possessed me. "Won't she answer the helm at all?" I said irritably to the man whose strong brown hands, grasping the spokes of the wheel, stood out lighted on the darkness, like a symbol of mankind's claim to the direction of its own fate. He answered me, "Yes, sir, she's coming to," slowly. "Let her head come up to south." "Aye, aye, sir." I paced the poop. There was not a sound but that of my footsteps till the man spoke again. "She is at south now, sir." I felt a slight tightness of the chest before I gave out the first course of my command to the silent night, heavy with dew and sparkling with stars. There was a finality in the act, committing me to the endless vigilance of my lonely task. "Steady her head at that," I said at last. "The course is south."
"South, sir," echoed the man.
I sent below the second mate and his watch, and remained in charge, walking the deck through the chill, somnolent hours that precede the dawn. Slight puffs came and went, and whenever they were strong enough to wake up the black water, the murmur alongside ran through my very heart in a delicate crescendo of delight, and died away swiftly. I was bitterly tired. The very stars seemed weary of waiting for daybreak. It came at last with a mother-of-pearl sheen at the zenith, such as I had never seen before in the tropics, unglowing, almost grey, with a strange reminder of high latitudes. The voice of the lookout man hailed from forward.
"Land on the port bow, sir."
"All right." Leaning on the rail, I never even raised my eyes. The motion of the ship was imperceptible. Presently Ransom brought me the cup of morning coffee. After I had drunk it, I looked ahead, and in the still streak of very pale orange light, I saw the land profiled flatly as if cut out of black paper and seeming to float on the water as light as cork. But the rising sun turned it into mere dark vapour, a doubtful, massive shadow trembling in the hot glare. The watch finished washing decks. I went below and stopped at Mr. Byrne's door. He could not bear to have it shut, but hesitated to speak to him till he moved his eyes. I gave him the news. "Sighted Cape Leand at daylight, about 15 miles." He moved his lips then, but I heard no sound till I put my ear down and caught the peevish comment, "This is crawling. No luck." "Better luck than standing still, anyhow," I pointed out resignedly, and left him to whatever thoughts or fancies haunted his awful immobility. Later that morning, when relieved by my second officer, I threw myself on my couch, and for some 3 hours or so I really found oblivion. It was so perfect that on waking up I wondered where I was. Then came the immense relief of the thought, on board my ship, at sea, at sea. Through the portholes I beheld an unruffled, sun-smitten horizon, the horizon of a windless day. But its spaciousness alone was enough to give me a sense of a fortunate escape, a momentary exaltation of freedom. I stepped out into the saloon with my heart lighter than it had been for days. Ransom was at the sideboard, preparing to lay the table for the first sea dinner of the passage. He turned his head, and something in his eyes checked my modest elation. Instinctively I asked, "What is it now?" not expecting in the least the answer I got. It was given with that sort of contained serenity which was characteristic of the man. "I'm afraid we haven't left all the sickness behind us, sir." "We haven't? What's the matter?" He told me then that two of our men had been taken bad with fever in the night. One of them was burning and the other was shivering, but he thought it was pretty much the same thing. I thought so too. I felt shocked by the news. "One burning, the other shivering, you say?" "No, we haven't left the sickness behind. Do they look very ill?"
"Middling bad, sir."
Ransom's eyes gazed steadily into mine. We exchanged smiles. Ransom's a little wistful, as usual, mine no doubt grim enough to correspond with my secret exasperation. I said, "Was there any wind at all this morning?"
"Can hardly say that, sir. We've moved all the time, though. The land ahead seems a little nearer."
That was it. A little nearer. Whereas if we had had only a little more wind, only a very little more, we might, we should, have been abreast of Leand by this time and increasing our distance from that contaminated shore. And it was not only the distance. It seemed to me that a stronger breeze would have blown away the contamination which clung to the ship. It obviously did cling to the ship. Two men, one burning, one shivering. I felt a distinct reluctance to go and look at them. What was the good? Poison is poison. Tropical fever is tropical fever. But that it should have stretched its claw after us over the sea seemed to me an extraordinary and unfair license. I could hardly believe that it could be anything worse than the last desperate pluck of the evil from which we were escaping into the clean breath of the sea. If only that breath had been a little stronger. However, there was the quinine against the fever. I went into the spare cabin where the medicine chest was kept to prepare two doses.
I opened it, full of faith, as a man opens a miraculous shrine. The upper part was inhabited by a collection of bottles, all square-shouldered and as like each other as peas. Under that orderly array there were two drawers, stuffed as full of things as one could imagine, paper packages, bandages, cardboard boxes, officially labelled. The lower of the two, in one of its compartments, contained our provision of quinine. There were five bottles, all round, and all of a size. One was about a third full. The other four remained still wrapped up in paper and sealed. But I did not expect to see an envelope lying on top of them, a square envelope belonging, in fact, to the ship's stationery. It lay so that I could see it was not closed down, and on picking it up and turning it over, I perceived that it was addressed to myself. It contained a half-sheet of notepaper, which I unfolded with a queer sense of dealing with the uncanny, but without any excitement, as people meet and do extraordinary things in a dream. "My dear Captain," it began, but I ran to the signature. The writer was the doctor. The date was that of the day on which, returning from my visit to Mr. Burns in the hospital, I had found the excellent doctor waiting for me in the cabin, and when he told me that he had been putting in time inspecting the medicine chest for me. How bizarre! While expecting me to come in at any moment, he had been amusing himself by writing me a letter, and then, as I came in, had hastened to stuff it in the medicine chest drawer. A rather incredible proceeding. I turned to the text in wonder. In a large, hurried, but legible hand, the good, sympathetic man, for some reason, either of kindness or more likely impelled by the irresistible desire to express his opinion, with which he didn't want to damp my hopes before, was warning me not to put my trust in the beneficial effects of a change from land to sea. "I didn't want to add to your worries by discouraging your hopes," he wrote. "I am afraid that, medically speaking, the end of your troubles is not yet." In short, he expected me to have to fight a probable return of tropical illness. Fortunately, I had a good provision of quinine. I should put my trust in that, and administer it steadily when the ship's health would certainly improve. I crumpled up the letter and rammed it into my pocket. Ransom carried off two big doses to the men forward. As to myself, I did not go on deck as yet. I went instead to the door of Mr. Burns' room and gave him that news too. It was impossible to say the effect it had on him. At first I thought that he was speechless. His head lay sunk in the pillow. He moved his lips enough, however, to assure me that he was getting much stronger, a statement shockingly untrue on the face of it. That afternoon I took my watch as a matter of course. A great, overheated stillness enveloped the ship and seemed to hold her motionless in a flaming ambience composed in two shades of blue. Faint, hot puffs eddied nervelessly from her sails. And yet she moved. She must have. For as the sun was setting, we had drawn abreast of Cape Liant and dropped it behind us, an ominous retreating shadow in the last gleams of twilight. In the evening, under the crude glare of his lamp, Mr. Burns seemed to have come more to the surface of his bedding. It was as if a depressing hand had been lifted off him. He answered my few words by a comparatively long, connected speech. He asserted himself strongly. If he escaped being smothered by this stagnant heat, he said, he was confident that in a very few days he would be able to come up on deck and help me. While he was speaking, I trembled lest this effort of energy should leave him lifeless before my eyes. But I cannot deny that there was something comforting in his willingness. I made a suitable reply, but pointed out to him that the only thing that could really help us was wind, a fair wind. He rolled his head impatiently on the pillow. And it was not comforting in the least to hear him begin to mutter crazily about the late captain, that old man buried in latitude 8°20, right in our way, ambushed at the entrance of the gulf. "Are you still thinking of your late captain, Mr. Burns?" I said. "I imagine the dead feel no animosity against the living. They care nothing for them." "You don't know that one," he breathed out feebly. "No, I didn't know him, and he didn't know me, and so he can't have any grievance against me, anyway." "Yes, but there's all the rest of us on board," he insisted. I felt the inexpugnable strength of common sense being insidiously menaced by this gruesome, by this insane delusion. and I said, "You mustn't talk so much. You'll tire yourself."
"And there is the ship herself,"
he persisted in a whisper. "Now, not a word more," I said, stepping in and laying my hand on his cool forehead. It proved to me that this atrocious absurdity was rooted in the man himself and not in the disease, which apparently had emptied him of every power, mental and physical, except that one fixed idea. I avoided giving Mr. Burns any opening for conversation for the next few days. I merely used to throw him a hasty, cheery word when passing his door. I believe that if he had had the strength, he would have called out after me more than once, but he hadn't the strength. Ransom, however, observed to me one afternoon that the mate seemed to be picking up wonderfully. "Did he talk any nonsense to you of late?" I asked casually. "No, sir." Ransom was startled by the direct question, but after a pause he added equably, "He told me this morning, sir, that he was sorry he had to bury our late captain right in the ship's way, as one might say, out of the gulf." "Isn't this nonsense enough for you?" I asked, looking confidently at the intelligent, quiet face, on which the secret uneasiness in the man's breast had thrown a transparent veil of care. Ransom didn't know. He had not given a thought to the matter. And with a faint smile, he flitted away from me on his never-ending duties with his usual guarded activity. 2 more days passed. We had advanced a little way, a very little way, into the larger space of the Gulf of Siam. Seizing eagerly upon the elation of the first command thrown into my lap by the agency of Captain Giles, I had yet an uneasy feeling that such luck as this had got perhaps to be paid for in some way. I had held, professionally, a review of my chances. I was competent enough for that. At least, I thought so. I had a general sense of my preparedness which only a man pursuing a calling he loves can know. That feeling seemed to me the most natural thing in the world, as natural as breathing. I imagined I could not have lived without it. I don't know what I expected. Perhaps nothing else than that special intensity of existence which is the quintessence of youthful aspirations. Whatever I expected, I did not expect to be beset by hurricanes. I knew better than that. In the Gulf of Siam there are no hurricanes. But neither did I expect to find myself bound hand and foot to the hopeless extent which was revealed to me as the days went on. Not that the evil spell held us always motionless. Mysterious currents drifted us here and there with a stealthy power made manifest only by the changing vistas of the islands fringing the east shore of the gulf. And there were winds, too, fitful and deceitful. They raised hopes only to dash them into the bitterest disappointment, promises of advance ending in lost ground, expiring in sighs, dying into dumb stillness in which the currents had it all their own way, their own inimical way. The island of Koh Ring, a great black upheaved ridge amongst a lot of tiny islets lying upon the glassy water like a triton amongst minnows, seemed to be the centre of the fatal circle. It seemed impossible to get away from it. Day after day it remained in sight. More than once in a favourable breeze I would take its bearings in the fast-ebbing twilight, thinking that it was for the last time. Vain hope. A night of fitful airs would undo the gains of temporary favour, and the rising sun would throw out the black relief of Koh Ring, looking more barren, inhospitable, and grim than ever. "It's like being bewitched, upon my word," I said once to Mr. Burns, from my usual position in the doorway. He was sitting up in his bed-place. He was progressing toward the world of living men, if he could hardly have been said to have rejoined it yet. He nodded to me his frail and bony head in a wisely mysterious assent. "Ah, yes, I know what you mean," I said. "But you cannot expect me to believe that a dead man has the power to put out of joint the meteorology of this part of the world, though indeed it seems to have gone utterly wrong. The land and the sea breezes have got broken up into small pieces. We cannot depend upon them for 5 minutes together." "It won't be very long now before I can come up on deck," muttered Mr. Burns, "and then we shall see." Whether he meant this for a promise to grapple with supernatural evil, I couldn't tell. At any rate, it wasn't the kind of assurance I needed. On the other hand, I'd been living on deck practically night and day so as to take advantage of every chance to get my ship a little more to the southward. The mate, I could see, was extremely weak yet, and not quite rid of his delusion, which to me appeared but a symptom of his disease. At all events, the hopefulness of an invalid was not to be discouraged. I said, "You'll be most welcome there, I am sure, Mr. Burns. If you go on improving at this rate, you'll be presently one of the healthiest men in the ship." This pleased him, but his extreme emaciation converted his self-satisfied smile into a ghastly exhibition of long teeth under the red moustache. "Aren't the fellows improving, sir?" he asked soberly, with an extremely sensible expression of anxiety on his face. I answered him only with a vague gesture and went away from the door. The fact was that disease played with us capriciously very much as the winds did. It would go from one man to another with a lighter or heavier touch, which always left its mark behind, staggering some, knocking others over for a time, leaving this one, returning to another, so that all of them had now an invalidish aspect and a hunted, apprehensive look in their eyes, while Ransom and I, the only two completely untouched, went amongst them assiduously distributing quinine. It was a double fight. The adverse weather held us in front, and the disease pressed on our rear. I must say that the men were very good. The constant toil of trimming yards they faced willingly. But all spring was out of their limbs, and as I looked at them from the poop I could not keep from my mind the dreadful impression that they were moving in poisoned air. Down below, in his cabin, Mr. Burns had advanced so far as not only to be able to sit up, but even to draw up his legs. Clasping them with bony arms, like an animated skeleton, he emitted deep, impatient sighs. "The great thing to do, sir," he would tell me on every occasion when I gave him the chance, "the great thing is to get the ship past 8°20 of latitude. Once she's past that, we're all right." At first I used only to smile at him, though God knows I had not much heart left for smiles. But at last I lost my patience. "Oh, yes, the latitude 8°20. That's where you buried your late captain, isn't it?" Then, with severity, "Don't you think, Mr. Burns, it's about time you dropped all that nonsense?" He rolled at me his deep sunken eyes in a glance of invincible obstinacy. But for the rest he only muttered, just loud enough for me to hear, something about, "Not surprised. Find player some beastly trick yet." Such passages as this were not exactly wholesome for my resolution. The stress of adversity was beginning to tell on me. At the same time, I felt a contempt for that obscure weakness of my soul. I said to myself, disdainfully, that it should take much more than that to affect in the smallest degree my fortitude. I did not know then how soon and from what unexpected direction it would be attacked. It was the very next day. The sun had risen clear of the southern shoulder of Koh Ring, which still hung like an evil attendant on our port quarter. It was intensely hateful to my sight. During the night we had been heading all round the compass, trimming the yards again and again, to what I fear must have been for the most part imaginary puffs of air. Then, just about sunrise, we got for an hour an inexplicable steady breeze, right in our teeth. There was no sense in it. It fitted neither with the season of the year nor with the secular experience of seamen, as recorded in books, nor with the aspect of the sky. Only purposeful malevolence could account for it. It sent us travelling at a great pace away from our proper course, and if we had been out on pleasure sailing bent, it would have been a delightful breeze, with the awakened sparkle of the sea, with a sense of motion and a feeling of unwonted freshness. Then, all at once, as if disdaining to carry farther the sorry jest, it dropped and died out completely in less than 5 minutes. The ship's head swung where it listed. The stilled sea took on the polish of a steel plate in the calm. I went below, not because I meant to take some rest, but simply because I couldn't bear to look at it just then. The indefatigable Ransom was busy in the saloon. It had become a regular practice with him to give me an informal health report in the morning. He turned away from the sideboard with his usual pleasant, quiet gaze. No shadow rested on his intelligent forehead. "There are a good many of them middling bad this morning, sir," he said in a calm tone. "What, all knocked out?" "Only two actually in their bunks, sir, but..."
It's the last night that has done for them. We've had to pull and haul all the blessed time. I heard, sir. I had a mind to come out and help, only, you know.
Certainly not. You mustn't. The fellows lie at night about the decks, too. It isn't good for them.
Ransom assented, but men couldn't be looked after like children. Moreover, one could hardly blame them for trying for such coolness and such air as there was to be found on deck. He himself, of course, knew better. He was, indeed, a reasonable man, yet it would not have been hard to say that the others were not. The last few days had been for us like the ordeal of the fiery furnace. One really couldn't quarrel with their common, imprudent humanity making the best of the moment of relief when the night brought in the illusion of coolness and the starlight twinkled through the heavy, dew-laden air. Moreover, most of them were so weakened that hardly anything could be done without everybody that could totter mustering on the braces. No, it was no use remonstrating with them, but I fully believed that quinine was of very great use indeed. I believed in it. I pinned my faith to it. It would save the men, the ship, break the spell by its medicinal virtue, make time of no account, the weather but a passing worry, and like a magic powder working against mysterious malefices, secure the first passage of my first command against the evil powers of calms and pestilence. I looked upon it as more precious than gold, and unlike gold, of which there hardly ever seems to be enough anywhere, the ship had a sufficient store of it. I went in to get it with the purpose of weighing out doses. I stretched my hand with the feeling of a man reaching for an unfailing panacea, took up a fresh bottle and unrolled the wrapper, noticing as I did so that the ends, both top and bottom, had come unsealed. But why record all the swift steps of the appalling discovery? You have guessed the truth already. There was the wrapper, the bottle, and the white powder inside, some sort of powder, but it wasn't quinine. One look at it was quite enough. I remember that at the very moment of picking up the bottle, before I even dealt with the wrapper, the weight of the object I had in my hand gave me an instant premonition. Quinine is as light as feathers, and my nerves must have been exasperated into an extraordinary sensibility. I let the bottle smash itself on the floor. The stuff, whatever it was, felt gritty under the sole of my shoe. I snatched up the next bottle, and then the next. The weight alone told the tale. One after another they fell, breaking at my feet, not because I threw them down in my dismay, but slipping through my fingers as if this disclosure were too much for my strength. It is a fact that the very greatness of a mental shock helps one to bear up against it by producing a sort of temporary insensibility. I came out of the stateroom stunned, as if something heavy had dropped on my head. From the other side of the saloon, across the table, Ransom, with a duster in his hand, stared open-mouthed. I don't think that I looked wild. It is quite possible that I appeared to be in a hurry, because I was instinctively hastening up on deck. An example, this, of training become instinct. The difficulties, the dangers, the problems of a ship at sea must be met on deck. To this fact, as it were, of nature, I responded instinctively, which may be taken as a proof that for a moment I must have been robbed of my reason. I was certainly off my balance, a prey to impulse, for at the bottom of the stairs I turned and flung myself at the doorway of Mr. Burns' cabin. The wildness of his aspect checked my mental disorder. He was sitting up in his bunk, his body looking immensely long, his head drooping a little sideways with affected complacency. He flourished in his trembling hand, on the end of a forearm no thicker than a walking stick, a shining pair of scissors which he tried before my very eyes to jab at his throat. I was, to a certain extent, horrified, but it was rather a secondary sort of effect, not really strong enough to make me yell at him in some such manner as, "Stop! Heavens! What are you doing?" In reality, he was simply overtaxing his returning strength in a shaky attempt to clip off the thick growth of his red beard. A large towel was spread over his lap, and a shower of stiff hairs like bits of copper wire was descending on it at every snip of the scissors. He turned to me, his face grotesque beyond the fantasies of mad dreams, one cheek all bushy as if with a swollen flame, the other denuded and sunken, with the untouched long moustache on that side asserting itself, lonely and fierce. And while he stared thunderstruck with the gaping scissors on his fingers,
I shouted my discovery at him fiendishly, in 6 words, without comment.
End of chapter 4. Chapter 5 of The Shadow Line by Joseph Conrad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. The Shadow Line, Chapter 5. I heard the clatter of the scissors escaping from his hand, noted the perilous heave of his whole person over the edge of the bunk after them, and then, returning to my first purpose, pursued my course on the deck. The sparkle of the sea filled my eyes. It was gorgeous and barren, monotonous and without hope under the empty curve of the sky. The sails hung motionless and slack, the very folds of their sagging surfaces moved no more than carved granite. The impetuosity of my advent made the man at the helm start slightly. A block aloft squeak incomprehensibly, for what on earth could have made it do so? It was a whistling note, like a bird's. For a long, long time I faced an empty world, steeped in an infinity of silence, through which the sunshine poured and flowed for some mysterious purpose. Then I heard Ransom's voice at my elbow. "I have put Mr. Burns back to bed, sir." "You have? Well, sir, he got out all of a sudden, but when he let go the edge of his bunk, he fell down. He isn't light-headed, though, it seems to me." "No," I said dully, without looking at Ransom. He waited for a moment, then cautiously, as if not to give offence. "I don't think we need lose much of that stuff, sir," he said. "I can sweep it up, every bit of it almost, and then we could sift the glass out. I will go about it at once. It will not make the breakfast late, not 10 minutes. "Oh, yes," I said bitterly. "Let the breakfast wait, sweep up every bit of it, and then throw the damn lot overboard." The profound silence returned, and when I looked over my shoulder, Ransom, the intelligent, serene Ransom, had vanished from my side. The intense loneliness of the sea acted like poison in my brain. When I turned my eyes to the ship, I had a morbid vision of her as a floating grave. Who hasn't heard of ships found floating, haphazard, with their crews all dead? I looked at the seaman at the helm. I had an impulse to speak to him, and indeed his face took on an expectant cast, as if he had guessed my intention. But in the end I went below, thinking I would be alone with the greatness of my trouble for a little while. But through his open door Mr. Burns saw me come down and addressed me grumpily. "Well, sir?" I went in. "It isn't well at all," I said. Mr. Burns, re-established in his bed-place, was concealing his hirsute cheek in the palm of his hand. "That confounded fellow has taken away the scissors from me," were the next words he said. The tension I was suffering from was so great that it was perhaps just as well that Mr. Burns had started on his grievance. He seemed very sore about it, and grumbled. "Does he think I'm mad, or what?" "I don't think so, Mr. Burns," I said. I looked upon him at that moment as a model of self-possession. I even conceived on that account a sort of admiration for that man, who had, apart from the intense materiality of what was left of his beard, come as near to being a disembodied spirit as any man can do and live. I noticed the preternatural sharpness of the ridge of his nose, the deep cavities of his temples, and I envied him. He was so reduced that he would probably die very soon. Enviable man, so near extinction, while I had to bear within me a tumult of suffering vitality, doubt, confusion, self-reproach, and an indefinite reluctance to meet the horrid logic of the situation. I could not help muttering, "I feel as if I were going mad myself." Mr. Burns glared spectrally, but otherwise was wonderfully composed. "I always thought he would play us some deadly trick," he said, with a peculiar emphasis on the he. It gave me a mental shock, but I had neither the mind nor the heart nor the spirit to argue with him. My form of sickness was indifference, the creeping paralysis of a hopeless outlook. So I only gazed at him. Mr. Burns broke into further speech. "Eh, what? No? You won't believe it? Well, how do you account for this? How do you think it could have happened?" "Happened?" I repeated dully. "Why, yes, how in the name of the infernal powers did this thing happen?"
Indeed, on thinking it out, it seemed incomprehensible that it should just be like this. The bottles emptied, refilled, rewrapped and replaced. A sort of plot, a sinister attempt to deceive, a thing resembling sly vengeance, but for what? Or else a fiendish joke. But Mr. Burns was in possession of a theory. It was simple, and he uttered it solemnly, in a hollow voice. I suppose they have given him about £15 in Haiphong for that little lot. Mr. Burns, I cried. He nodded grotesquely over his raised legs, like two broomsticks in the pyjamas, with enormous bare feet at the end. Why not? The stuff is pretty expensive in this part of the world, and they were very short of it in Tonkin. And what did he care? You have not known him. I have, and I have defied him. He feared neither God, nor devil, nor man, nor wind, nor sea, nor his own conscience. And I believe he hated everybody and everything. But I think he was afraid to die. I believe I am the only man who ever stood up to him. I faced him in that cabin where you live now, when he was sick, and I cowered him then. He thought I was going to twist his neck for him. If he had had his way, we would have been beating up against the northeast monsoon, as long as he lived, and afterward too, for ages and ages, acting the Flying Dutchman in the China Sea. Ha, ha! But why should he replace the bottles like this? I began. Why shouldn't he? Why should he want to throw the bottles away? They fit the drawer. They belong to the medicine chest. And they were wrapped up, I cried. Well, the wrappers were there. Did it from habit, I suppose. And as to refilling, there is always a lot of stuff they send in paper parcels that burst after a time. And then, who can tell? I suppose you didn't taste it, sir. But of course you are sure. No, I said, I didn't taste it. It is all overboard now. Behind me, a soft, cultivated voice said, I have tasted it. It seemed a mixture of all sorts, sweetish, saltish, very horrible. Ransom, stepping out of the pantry, had been listening for some time, as it was very excusable in him to do. A dirty trick, said Mr. Burns. I always said he would. The magnitude of my indignation was unbounded, and the kind, sympathetic doctor, too, the only sympathetic man I ever knew. Instead of writing that warming letter, the very refinement of sympathy, why didn't the man make a proper inspection? But as a matter of fact, it was hardly fair to blame the doctor. The fittings were in order, and the medicine chest is an officially arranged affair. There was nothing really to arouse the slightest suspicion. The person I could never forgive was myself. Nothing should ever be taken for granted. The seed of everlasting remorse was sown in my breast. I feel it's all my fault, I exclaimed. Mine and nobody else's. That's how I feel. I shall never forgive myself. That's very foolish, sir, said Mr. Burns fiercely. And after this effort he fell back, exhausted, on his bed. He closed his eyes. He panted. This affair, this abominable surprise, had shaken him up, too. As I turned away, I perceived Ransom looking at me blankly. He appreciated what it meant, but managed to produce his pleasant, wistful smile. Then he stepped back into his pantry, and I rushed up on deck again to see whether there was any wind, any breath under the sky, any stir of the air, any sign of hope. The deadly stillness met me again. Nothing was changed except that there was a different man at the wheel. He looked ill. His whole figure drooped, and he seemed rather to cling to the spokes than hold them with a controlling grip. I said to him, "You're not fit to be here." "I can manage, sir," he said feebly. As a matter of fact, there was nothing for him to do. The ship had no steerage way. She lay with her head to the westward, the everlasting coral ring visible over the stern, with a few small islets, black spots in the great blaze, swimming before my troubled eyes. And but for those bits of land, there was no speck on the sky, no speck on the water, no shape of vapour, no wisp of smoke, no sail, no boat, no stir of humanity, no sign of life, nothing. The first question was, what to do? What could one do? The first thing to do, obviously, was to tell the men. I did it that very day. I wasn't going to let the knowledge simply get about. I would face them. They were assembled on the quarter-deck for the purpose. Just before I stepped out to speak to them, I discovered that life could hold terrible moments. No confessed criminal had ever been so oppressed by his sense of guilt. This is why, perhaps, my face was set hard and my voice curt and unemotional while I made my declaration that I could do nothing more for the sick in the way of drugs. As to such care as could be given them, they knew they had had it. I would have held them justified in tearing me limb from limb. The silence which followed upon my words was almost harder to bear than the angriest uproar. I was crushed by the infinite depth of its reproach. But, as a matter of fact, I was mistaken. In a voice which I had great difficulty in keeping firm, I went on, "I suppose, men, you have understood what I said, and you know what it means?" A voice or two were heard. "Yes, sir, we understand." They had kept silent simply because they thought that they were not called to say anything, and when I told them that I intended to run into Singapore, and that the best chance for the ship and the men was in the efforts all of us, sick and well, must make to get her along out of this, I received the encouragement of a low assenting murmur, and of a louder voice exclaiming, "Surely there's a way out of this blamed hole." Here is an extract from the notes I wrote at the time. "We have lost Koh Ring at last. For many days now I don't think I have been 2 hours below altogether. I remain on deck, of course, night and day, and the nights and days wheel over us in succession, whether long or short, who can say? All sense of time is lost in the monotony of expectation, of hope and of desire, which is only one. Get the ship to the southward. Get the ship to the southward." The effect is curiously mechanical. The sun climbs and descends. The night swings over our heads as if somebody below the horizon were turning a crank. It is the prettiest, the most aimless, and all through that miserable performance I go on, tramping, tramping the deck. How many miles have I walked on the poop of that ship? A stubborn pilgrimage of sheer restlessness, diversified by short excursions below to look upon Mr. Burns. I don't know whether it is an illusion, but he seems to become more substantial from day to day. He doesn't say much, for indeed the situation doesn't lend itself to idle remarks. I notice this even with the men as I watch them moving or sitting about the decks. They don't talk to each other. It strikes me that if there exists an invisible ear catching the whispers of the earth, it will find this ship the most silent spot on it. No, Mr. Burns has not much to say to me. He sits in his bunk with his beard gone, his moustaches flaming, and with an air of silent determination on his chalky physiognomy. Ransom tells me he devours all the food that is given to him to the last scrap, but that apparently he sleeps very little. Even at night, when I go below to fill my pipe, I notice that, though dozing flat on his back, he still looks very determined. From the side glance he gives me when awake, it seems as though he were annoyed at being interrupted in some arduous mental operation. And as I emerge on deck, the ordered arrangement of the stars meets my eye, unclouded, infinitely wearisome. There they are, stars, sun, sea, light, darkness, space, great waters, the formidable work of the 7 days, into which mankind seems to have blundered unbidden, or else decoyed, even as I have been decoyed into this awful, this death-haunted command. The only spot of light in the ship at night was that of the compass lamps lighting up the faces of the succeeding helmsmen. For the rest we were lost in the darkness, I walking the poop and the men lying about the decks. They were all so reduced by sickness that no watches could be kept. Those who were able to walk remained all the time on duty, lying about in the shadows of the main deck, till my voice raised for an order would bring them to their enfeebled feet, a tottering little group, moving patiently about the ship with hardly a murmur, a whisper amongst them all. And every time I had to raise my voice it was with a pang of remorse and pity. Then, about 4 o'clock in the morning, a light would gleam forward in the galley. The unfailing Ransom of the uneasy heart, immune, serene and active, was getting ready for the early coffee for the men. Presently he would bring me a cup up on the poop, and it was then that I allowed myself to drop into my deck chair for a couple of hours of real sleep. No doubt I must have been snatching short doses when leaning against the rail for a moment in sheer exhaustion, but honestly I was not aware of them, except in the painful form of convulsive starts that seemed to come on me even while I walked. From about 5, however, until after 7, I would sleep openly under the fading stars. I would say to the helmsman, "Call me at need," and drop into that chair and close my eyes, feeling that there was no more sleep for me on earth. And then I would know nothing until, sometime between 7 and 8, I would feel a touch on my shoulder and look up at Ransom's face with its faint, wistful smile and friendly grey eyes, as though he were tenderly amused at my slumbers. Occasionally the second mate would come up and relieve me at early coffee time, but it didn't really matter. Generally it was a dead calm, or else faint airs so changing and fugitive that it really wasn't worthwhile to touch a brace for them. If the air steadied at all, the seaman at the helm could be trusted for a warning shout, "Ship's all aback, sir," which, like a trumpet call, would make me spring a foot above the deck. Those were the words which, it seemed to me, would have made me spring up from eternal sleep. But this was not often. I have never met since such breathless sunrises. And if the second mate happened to be there, he had generally one day in 3 free of fever, I would find him sitting on the skylight, half senseless, as it were, and with an idiotic gaze fastened on some object nearby, a rope, a cleat, a belaying pin, a ring bolt. That young man was rather troublesome. He remained cubbish in his sufferings. He seemed to have become completely imbecile, and when the return of fever drove him to his cabin below, the next thing would be that we would miss him from there. The first time it happened, Ransom and I were very much alarmed. We started a quiet search, and ultimately Ransom discovered him curled up in the sail locker, which opened into the lobby by a sliding door. When remonstrated with, he muttered sulkily, "It's cool in there." That wasn't true. It was only dark there. The fundamental defects of his face were not improved by its uniform livid hue. The disease disclosed its low type in a startling way. It was not so with many of the men. The wastage of ill health seemed to idealize the general character of the features, bringing out the unsuspected nobility of some, the strength of others, and in one case revealing an essentially comic aspect. He was a short, gingery, active man with a nose and chin of the punch type, and whom his shipmates called Frenchy. I don't know why. He may have been a Frenchman, but I've never heard him utter a single word in French. To see him coming after the wheel comforted one. The blue dungaree trousers turned up the calf, one leg a little higher than the other, the clean check shirt, the white canvas cap, evidently made by himself, made up a whole of peculiar smartness, and the persistent jauntiness of his gait, even, poor fellow, when he couldn't help tottering, told of his invincible spirit. There was also a man called Gambrel. He was the only grizzled person in the ship. His face was of an austere type. But if I remember all their faces, wasting tragically before my eyes, most of their names have vanished from my memory. The words that passed between us were few and puerile in regard of the situation. I had to force myself to look them in the face. I expected to meet reproachful glances. There were none. The expression of suffering in their eyes was indeed hard enough to bear, but that they couldn't help. For the rest, I asked myself whether it was the temper of their souls or the sympathy of their imagination that made them so wonderful, so worthy of my undying regard. For myself, neither my soul was highly tempered nor my imagination properly under control. There were moments when I felt not only that I would go mad, but that I had gone mad already, so that I dared not open my lips for fear of betraying myself by some insane shriek. Luckily, I had only orders to give, and an order has a steadying influence upon him who has to give it. Moreover, the seaman, the officer of the watch in me, was sufficiently sane. I was like a mad carpenter making a box. Were he ever so convinced that he was king of Jerusalem, the box he would make would be a sane box. What I feared was a shrill note escaping me involuntarily and upsetting my balance. Luckily, again, there was no necessity to raise one's voice. The brooding stillness of the world seemed sensitive to the slightest sound, like a whispering gallery. The conversational tone would almost carry a word from one end of the ship to the other. The terrible thing was that the only voice that I ever heard was my own. At night, especially, it reverberated very lonely amongst the planes of the unstirring sails. Mr. Burns, still keeping to his bed with that air of secret determination, was moved to grumble at many things. Our interviews were short, 5-minute affairs, but fairly frequent. I was everlastingly diving down below to get a light, though I did not consume much tobacco at that time. The pipe was always going out, for in truth my mind was not composed enough to enable me to get a decent smoke. Likewise, for most of the time during the 24 hours, I could have struck matches on deck and held them aloft till the flame burnt my fingers. But I always used to run below. It was a change. It was the only break in the incessant strain. And, of course, Mr. Burns, through the open door, could see me come in and go out every time. With his knees gathered up under his chin and staring with his greenish eyes over them, he was a weird figure, and with my knowledge of the crazy notion in his head, not a very attractive one for me. Still, I had to speak to him now and then, and one day he complained that the ship was very silent. For hours and hours, he said, he was lying there, not hearing a sound, till he did not know what to do with himself.
When Ransom happens to be forward in his galley, everything so still one might think everybody in the ship was dead, he grumbled. The only voice I do hear sometimes is yours, sir, and that isn't enough to cheer me up. What's the matter with the men? Isn't there one left that can sing out at the ropes?
Not one, Mr. Burns, I said. There is no breath to spare on board this ship for that. Are you aware that there are times when I can't muster more than 3 hands to do anything? He asked swiftly but fearfully. Nobody dead yet, sir?
No. It wouldn't do, Mr. Burns declared forcibly. Mustn't let him. If he gets hold of one, he will get them all.
I cried out angrily at this. I believe I even swore at the disturbing effect of these words. They attacked all the self-possession that was left of me. In my endless vigil in the face of the enemy, I had been haunted by gruesome images enough. I had had visions of a ship drifting in calms and swinging in light airs, with all her crew dying slowly about her decks. Such things had been known to happen. Mr. Burns met my outburst by a mysterious silence.
"Look here," I said. "You don't believe yourself what you say. You can't. It's impossible. It isn't the sort of thing I have a right to expect from you. My position's bad enough without being worried with your silly fancies."
He remained unmoved. On account of the way in which the light fell on his beard, I could not be sure whether he had smiled faintly or not. I changed my tone. "Listen," I said. "It's getting so desperate that I had thought for a moment, since we can't make our way south, whether I wouldn't try to steer west and make an attempt to reach the mailboat track. We could always get some quinine from her, at least. What do you think?"
He cried out, "No, no, no, don't do that, sir. You mustn't for a moment give up facing that old ruffian. If you do, he will get the upper hand of us."
I left him. He was impossible. It was like a case of possession. His protest, however, was essentially quite sound. As a matter of fact, my notion of heading out west on the chance of sighting a problematical steamer could not bear calm examination. On the side where we were, we had enough wind, at least from time to time, to struggle on towards the south. Enough, at least, to keep hope alive. But suppose I had used those capricious gusts of wind to sail away to the westward, into some region where there was not a breath of air for days on end. What then? Perhaps my appalling vision of a ship floating with a dead crew would become a reality for the discovery weeks afterwards by some horror-stricken mariners. That afternoon Ransom brought me up a cup of tea, and while waiting there, tray in hand, he remarked, in the exactly right tone of sympathy, "You're holding out well, sir." "Yes," I said, "you and I seem to have been forgotten."
"Forgotten, sir?"
"Yes, by the fever devil who has got on board this ship," I said. Ransom gave me one of his attractive, intelligent, quick glances and went away with the tray. It occurred to me that I had been talking somewhat in Mr. Burns' manner. It annoyed me. Yet often in darker moments I forgot myself into an attitude towards our troubles more fit for a contest against a living enemy. Yes, the devil fever had not laid his hand yet either on Ransom or on me. But he might at any time. It was one of those thoughts one had to fight down, keep at arm's length at any cost. It was unbearable to contemplate the possibility of Ransom, the housekeeper of the ship, being laid low. And what would happen to my command if I got knocked over, with Mr. Burns too weak to stand without holding on to his bed place, and the second mate reduced to a state of permanent imbecility? It was impossible to imagine, or rather, it was only too easy to imagine. I was alone on the poop. The ship having no steerage way, I had sent the helmsman away to sit down or lie down somewhere in the shade. The men's strength was so reduced that all unnecessary calls on it had to be avoided. It was the austere Gambrel with a grisly beard. He went away readily enough, but he was so weakened by repeated bouts of fever, poor fellow, that in order to get down the poop ladder he had to turn sideways and hang on with both hands to the brass rail. It was just simply heartbreaking to watch. Yet he was neither very much worse nor much better than most of the half-dozen miserable victims I could muster up on deck. It was a terribly lifeless afternoon. For several days in succession, low clouds had appeared in the distance, white masses with dark convolutions resting on the water, motionless, almost solid, and yet all the time changing their aspects subtly. Towards evening they vanished, as a rule, but this day they awaited the setting sun, which glowed and smouldered sulkily amongst them before it sank down. The punctual and wearisome stars reappeared over our mastheads, but the air remained stagnant and oppressive. The unfailing Ransom lighted the binnacle lamps and glided, all shadowy, up to me. "Will you go down and try to eat something, sir?" he suggested. His low voice startled me. I had been standing looking out over the rail, saying nothing, feeling nothing, not even the weariness of my limbs, overcome by the evil spell. "Ransom," I asked abruptly, "how long have I been on deck? I'm losing the notion of time." 12 days, sir," he said, "and it's just a fortnight since we left the anchorage." His equable voice sounded mournful somehow. He waited a bit, then added, "It's the first time that it looks as if we were to have some rain." I noticed then the broad shadow on the horizon, extinguishing the low stars completely, while those overhead, when I looked up, seemed to shine down on us through a veil of smoke. How it got there, how it had crept up so high, I couldn't say. It had an ominous appearance. The air did not stir. At a renewed invitation from Ransom, I did go down into the cabin to, in his own words, try and eat something. I don't know that the trial was very successful. I suppose at that period I did exist on food in the usual way, but the memory is now that in those days life was sustained on invincible anguish as a sort of infernal stimulant, exciting and consuming at the same time. It's the only period in my life in which I attempted to keep a diary. No, not the only one. Years later, in conditions of moral isolation, I did put down on paper the thoughts and events of a score of days. But this was the first time. I don't remember how it came about or how the pocket-book and the pencil came into my hands. It's inconceivable that I should have looked for them on purpose. I suppose they saved me from the crazy trick of talking to myself. Strangely enough, in both cases, I took to that sort of thing in circumstances in which I did not expect, in colloquial phrase, to come out of it. Neither could I expect the record to outlast me. This shows that it was a purely personal need for intimate relief and not a call of egotism. Here I must give another sample of it, a few detached lines, now looking very ghostly to my own eyes, out of the part scribbled that very evening. "There is something going on in the sky, like a decomposition, like a corruption of the air, which remains as still as ever. After all, mere clouds, which may or may not hold wind or rain. Strange that it should trouble me so. I feel as if all my sins had found me out. But I suppose the trouble is that the ship is still lying motionless, not under command, and that I have nothing to do to keep my imagination from running wild amongst the disastrous images of the worst that may befall us. What's going to happen? Probably nothing, or anything. It may be a furious squall coming, butt-end foremost, and on deck there are 5 men with the vitality and the strength of, say, 2. We may have all our sails blown away. Every stitch of canvas has been on us since we broke ground at the mouth of the Mee Nam 15 days ago, or 15 centuries. It seems to me that all my life before that momentous day is infinitely remote, a fading memory of light-hearted youth, something on the other side of a shadow. Yes, sails may very well be blown away, and that would be like a death sentence on the men. We haven't strength enough on board to bend another suit. Incredible thought, but it is true. Or we may even get dismasted. Ships have been dismasted in squalls simply because they weren't handled quick enough, and we have no power to whirl the yards around. It's like being bound hand and foot, preparatory to having one's throat cut. And what appalls me most of all is that I shrink from going on deck to face it. It's due to the ship. It's due to the men who are there on deck, some of them, ready to put out the last remnant of their strength at a word from me. I am shrinking from it, from the mere vision. My first command. Now I understand that strange sense of insecurity in my past. I always suspected that I might be no good, and here is proof positive. I am shirking it. I am no good. At that moment, or perhaps the moment after, I became aware of Ransom standing in the cabin. Something in his expression startled me. It had a meaning which I could not make out. I exclaimed, "Somebody's dead." It was his turn then to look startled. "Dead? Not that I know of, sir. I've been in the forecastle only 10 minutes ago, and there was no dead man there then." "You did give me a scare," I said. His voice was extremely pleasant to listen to. He explained that he had come down below to close Mr. Burns' port in case it should come on to rain. He did not know that I was in the cabin, he added. "How does it look outside?" I asked him. "Very black indeed, sir. There is something in it for certain." "In what quarter?" "All round, sir," I repeated idly. "All round, for certain," with my elbows on the table. Ransom lingered in the cabin, as if he had something to do there, but hesitated about doing it. I said suddenly, "You think I ought to be on deck?" He answered at once, but without any particular emphasis or accent, "I do, sir." I got to my feet briskly, and he made way for me to go out. As I passed through the lobby, I heard Mr. Burns' voice saying, "Shut the door of my room, will you, steward?" And Ransom's rather surprised, "Certainly, sir." I thought that all my feelings had been dulled into complete indifference, but I found it as trying as ever to be on deck. The impenetrable blackness beset the ship so close that it seemed that, by thrusting one's hand over the side, one could touch some unearthly substance. There was in it an effect of inconceivable terror and of inexpressible mystery. The few stars overhead shed a dim light upon the ship alone, with no gleams of any kind upon the water, in detached shafts piercing an atmosphere which had turned to soot. It was something I had never seen before, giving no hint of the direction from which any change would come, the closing in of a menace from all sides. There was still no man at the helm. The immobility of all things was perfect. If the air had turned black, the sea, for all I knew, might have turned solid. It was no good looking in any direction, watching for any sign, speculating upon the nearness of the moment. When the time came, the blackness would overwhelm silently the bit of starlight falling upon the ship, and the end of all things would come without a sigh, stir, or murmur of any kind, and all our hearts would cease to beat like run-down clocks. It was impossible to shake off that sense of finality. The quietness that came over me was like a foretaste of annihilation. It gave me a sort of comfort, as though my soul had become suddenly reconciled to an eternity of blind stillness. The seaman's instinct alone survived whole in my moral dissolution. I descended the ladder to the quarter-deck. The starlight seemed to die out before reaching that spot, but when I asked quietly, "Are you there, men?" my eyes made out shadow forms starting up around me, very few, very indistinct, and a voice spoke, "All here, sir." Another amended anxiously, "All that are any good for anything, sir." Both voices were very quiet and unringing, without any special character of readiness or discouragement, very matter-of-fact voices. "We must try to haul this mainsail close up," I said. The shadows swayed about me without a word. Those men were the ghosts of themselves, and their weight on a rope could be no more than the weight of a bunch of ghosts. Indeed, if ever a sail was hauled up by sheer spiritual strength, it must have been that sail, for, properly speaking, there was not muscle enough for the task in the whole ship, let alone the miserable lot of us on deck. Of course, I took the lead in the work myself. They wandered feebly after me from rope to rope, stumbling and panting. They toiled like titans. We were half an hour at it at least, and all the time the black universe made no sound. When the last leech line was made fast, my eyes, accustomed to the darkness, made out the shapes of exhausted men drooping over the rails, collapsed on hatches. One hung over the after capstan, sobbing for breath, and I stood amongst them like a tower of strength, impervious to disease and feeling only the sickness of my soul. I waited for some time, fighting against the weight of my sins, against my sense of unworthiness, and then I said, "Now, men, we'll go aft and square the mainyard. That's about all we can do for the ship, and for the rest, she must take her chance." End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of The Shadow Line by Joseph Conrad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. The Shadow Line, Chapter 6. As we all went up, it occurred to me that there ought to be a man at the helm. I raised my voice not much above a whisper, and, noiselessly, an uncomplaining spirit in a fever-wasted body appeared in the light, aft, the head with hollow eyes illuminated against the blackness which had swallowed up our world, and the universe. The bared forearm extended over the upper spokes seemed to shine with a light of its own. I murmured to that luminous appearance, "Keep the helm right amidships." It answered in a tone of patient suffering, "Right amidships, sir." Then I descended to the quarter-deck. It was impossible to tell whence the blow would come. To look round the ship was to look into a bottomless black pit. The eye lost itself in inconceivable depths. I wanted to ascertain whether the ropes had been picked up off the deck. One could only do that by feeling with one's feet. In my cautious progress, I came against a man in whom I recognized Ransom. He possessed an unimpaired physical solidity which was manifest to me at the contact. He was leaning against the quarter-deck capstan and kept silent. It was like a revelation. He was the collapsed figure, sobbing for breath, I had noticed before we went on the poop. "You've been helping with the mainsail," I exclaimed in a low tone. "Yes, sir," sounded his quiet voice. "Man, what were you thinking of? You mustn't do that sort of thing." After a pause, he assented, "I suppose I mustn't." Then, after another short silence, he added, "I'm all right now," quickly, between the telltale gasps. I could neither hear nor see anybody else, but when I spoke up, answering sad murmurs filled the quarter-deck, and its shadows seemed to shift here and there. I ordered all the halyards laid down on deck, clear for running. "I'll see to that, sir," volunteered Ransom in his natural pleasant tone, which comforted one and aroused one's compassion, too, somehow. That man ought to have been in his bed resting, and my plain duty was to send him there. But perhaps he would not have obeyed me. I had not the strength of mind to try. All I said was, "Go about it quietly, Ransom." Returning on the poop, I approached Gambrel. His face, set with hollow shadows in the light, looked awful, finally silenced. I asked him how he felt, but hardly expected an answer. Therefore I was astonished at his comparative loquacity. "Them shakes leaves me as weak as a kitten, sir," he said, preserving finally that air of unconsciousness as to anything but his business a helmsman should never lose. "And before I can pick up my strength, that there hot fit comes along and knocks me over again." He sighed. There was no reproach in his tone, but the bare words were enough to give me a horrible pang of self-reproach. It held me dumb for a time. When the tormenting sensation had passed off, I asked, "Do you feel strong enough to prevent the rudder taking charge if she gets sternway on her? It wouldn't do to get something smashed about the steering gear now. We've enough difficulties to cope with as it is." He answered with just a shade of weariness that he was strong enough to hang on. He could promise me that she wouldn't take the wheel out of his hands. More he couldn't say. At that moment Ransom appeared quite close to me, stepping out of the darkness into visibility suddenly, as if just created, with his composed face and pleasant voice. "Every rope on deck," he said, "was laid down clear for running, as far as one could make certain by feeling. It was impossible to see anything. Frenchy had stationed himself forward. He said he had a jump or two left in him yet." Here a faint smile altered for an instant the clear, firm design of Ransom's lips. With his serious, clear grey eyes, his serene temperament, he was a priceless man altogether, soul as firm as the muscles of his body. He was the only man on board, except me, but I had to preserve my liberty of movement, who had a sufficiency of muscular strength to trust to. For a moment I thought I had better ask him to take the wheel, but the dreadful knowledge of the enemy he had to carry about him made me hesitate. In my ignorance of physiology, it occurred to me that he might die suddenly from excitement at a critical moment. While this gruesome fear restrained the ready words on the tip of my tongue, Ransom stepped back 2 paces and vanished from my sight. At once an uneasiness possessed me, as if some support had been withdrawn. I moved forward, too, outside the circle of light, into the darkness that stood in front of me like a wall. In one stride I penetrated it. Such must have been the darkness before creation. It had closed behind me. I knew I was invisible to the man at the helm. Neither could I see anything. He was alone. I was alone. Every man was alone where he stood. And every form was gone, too. Spar, sail, fittings, rails. Everything was blotted out in the dreadful smoothness of that absolute night. A flash of lightning would have been a relief, I mean, physically. I would have prayed for it if it hadn't been for my shrinking apprehension of the thunder. In the tension of silence I was suffering from, it seemed to me that the first crash must turn me into dust. And thunder was, most likely, what would happen next. Stiff all over and hardly breathing, I waited with a horribly strained expectation. Nothing happened. It was maddening, but a dull, growing ache in the lower part of my face made me aware that I had been grinding my teeth madly enough for God knows how long. It's extraordinary I should not have heard myself doing it, but I hadn't. By an effort which absorbed all my faculties, I managed to keep my jaw still. It required much attention, and while thus engaged, I became bothered by curious, irregular sounds of faint tapping on the deck. They could be heard single, in pairs, in groups. While I wondered at this mysterious devilry, I received a slight blow under the left eye and felt an enormous tear run down my cheek. Raindrops, enormous, forerunners of something. Tap, tap, tap. I turned about, and addressing Gambrel earnestly, entreated him to hang on to the wheel. But I could hardly speak from emotion. The fatal moment had come. I held my breath. The tapping had stopped as unexpectedly as it had begun, and there was a renewed moment of intolerable suspense, something like an additional turn of the racking screw. I don't suppose I would have ever screamed, but I remember my conviction that there was nothing else for it but to scream. Suddenly, how am I to convey it? Well, suddenly, the darkness turned into water. This is the only suitable figure. A heavy shower, a downpour, comes along, making a noise. You hear its approach on the sea, in the air too, I verily believe. But this was different. With no preliminary whisper or rustle, without a splash, and even without a ghost of impact, I became instantaneously soaked to the skin. Not a very difficult matter, since I was wearing only my sleeping suit. My hair got full of water in an instant. Water streamed on my skin. It filled my nose, my ears, my eyes. In a fraction of a second I swallowed quite a lot of it. As to Gambrel, he was fairly choked. He coughed pitifully, the broken cough of a sick man, and I beheld him as one sees a fish in an aquarium by the light of an electric bulb, an elusive phosphorescent shape. And he did not glide away. But something else happened. Both binnacle lamps went out. I suppose the water forced itself into them, though I wouldn't have thought that possible, for they fitted into the cowl perfectly. The last gleam of light in the universe had gone, pursued by a low exclamation of dismay from Gambrel. I groped for him and seized his arm. How startlingly wasted it was. "Never mind," I said. "You don't want the light. All you need to do is to keep the wind when it comes at the back of your head. You understand?
Aye, aye, sir. But I should like to have a light, he added nervously.
All that time the ship lay as steady as a rock. The noise of the water pouring off the sails and spars, flowing over the break of the poop, had stopped short. The poop scuppers gurgled and sobbed for a little while longer, and then perfect silence, joined to perfect immobility, proclaimed the yet unbroken spell of our helplessness, poised on the edge of some violent issue lurking in the dark. I started forward restlessly. I did not need my sight to pace the poop of my first ill-starred command with perfect assurance. Every square foot of her decks was impressed indelibly on my brain, to the very grain and knots of the planks. Yet, all of a sudden, I fell clean over something, landing full length on my hands and face. It was something big and alive, not a dog, more like a sheep, rather. But there were no animals in the ship. How could an animal... It was an added and fantastic horror which I could not resist. The hair on my head stirred even as I picked myself up, awfully scared, not as a man is scared while his judgment, his reason, still try to resist, but completely, boundlessly, and, as it were, innocently scared, like a little child. I could see it, that thing. The darkness, of which so much had just turned into water, had thinned down a little. There it was, but I did not hit upon the notion of Mr. Burns issuing out of the companion on all fours till he attempted to stand up, and even then the idea of a bear crossed my mind first. He growled like one when I seized him round the body. He had buttoned himself up into an enormous winter overcoat of some woolly material, the weight of which was too much for his reduced state. I could hardly feel the incredibly thin lath of his body, lost within the thick stuff, but his growl had depth and substance. Confounded dump ship with a craven, tiptoeing crowd! Why couldn't they stamp and go with a brace? Wasn't there one godforsaken lubber in the lot fit to raise a yell on a rope? Skulking's no good, sir. He attacked me directly. You can't slink past the old murderous ruffian. It isn't the way. You must go for him boldly, as I did. Boldness is what you want. Show him that you don't care for any of his damned tricks. Kick up a jolly old row. Good God, Mr. Burns, I said angrily, what on earth are you up to? What do you mean by coming up on deck in this state? Just that, boldness, the only way to scare the old bullying rascal. I pushed him, still growling, against the rail. Hold on to it, I said roughly. I did not know what to do with him. I left him in a hurry to go to Gambrel, who had called faintly that he believed there was some wind aloft. Indeed, my own ears had caught a feeble flutter of wet canvas high up overhead, the jingle of a slack chain sheet. These were eerie, disturbing, alarming sounds in the dead stillness of the air around me. All the instances I had heard of topmasts being whipped out of a ship while there was not wind enough on her deck to blow out a match rushed into my memory. "I can't see the upper sail, sir," declared Gambrel shakily. "Don't move the helm. You'll be all right," I said confidently. The poor man's nerves were gone. Mine were not in much better case. It was the moment of breaking strain, and was relieved by the abrupt sensation of the ship moving forward as if of herself under my feet. I heard plainly the soughing of the wind aloft, the low cracks of the upper spars taking the strain, long before I could feel the least draught on my face turned aft, anxious and sightless, like the face of a blind man. Suddenly a louder-sounding note filled our ears. The darkness started streaming against our bodies, chilling them exceedingly. Both of us, Gambrel and I, shivered violently in our clinging, soaked garments of thin cotton. I said to him, "You're all right now, my man. All you've got to do is to keep the wind at the back of your head. Surely you're up to that. A child could steer this ship in smooth water." He muttered, "Aye, a healthy child." And I felt ashamed of having been passed over by the fever which had been preying on every man's strength but mine, in order that my remorse might be the more bitter, the feeling of unworthiness more poignant, and the sense of responsibility heavier to bear. The ship had gathered great way on her almost at once on the calm water. I felt her slipping through it with no other noise but a mysterious rustle alongside. Otherwise she had no motion at all, neither lift nor roll. It was a disheartening steadiness which had lasted for 18 days now, for never, never had we had wind enough in that time to raise the slightest run of the sea. The breeze freshened suddenly. I thought it was high time to get Mr. Burns off the deck. He worried me. I looked upon him as a lunatic who would be very likely to start roaming over the ship and break a limb or fall overboard. I was truly glad to find he had remained holding on where I had left him, sensibly enough. He was, however, muttering to himself ominously. This was discouraging. I remarked in a matter-of-fact tone, "We've never had so much wind as this since we left the roads." "There's some heart in it, too," he growled judiciously. It was a remark of a perfectly sane seaman, but he added immediately, "It was about time I should come on deck. I've been nursing my strength for this, just for this. Do you see it, sir?" I said I did, and proceeded to hint that it would be advisable for him to go below now and take a rest. His answer was an indignant, "Go below? Not if I know it, sir." Very cheerful. He was a horrible nuisance, and all at once he started to argue. I could feel his crazy excitement in the dark. "You don't know how to go about it, sir. How could you? All this whispering and tiptoeing is no good. You can't hope to slink past a cunning, wide-awake, evil brute like he was. You never heard him talk. Enough to make your hair stand on end. No, no, he wasn't mad. He was no more mad than I am. He was just downright wicked. Wicked so as to frighten most people. I will tell you what he was. He was nothing less than a thief and a murderer at heart. And do you think he's any different now because he's dead? Not he. His carcass lies 100 fathoms under, but he's just the same, in latitude 8°20 north. He snorted defiantly. I noted with weary resignation that the breeze had got lighter while he raved. He was at it again. "I ought to have thrown the beggar out of the ship over the rail, like a dog. It was only on account of the men. Fancy having to read the burial service over a brute like that. Our departed brother." I could have laughed. That was what he couldn't bear. I suppose I'm the only man that ever stood up to laugh at him. When he got sick, it used to scare that brother, brother, departed. Sooner call a shark brother. The breeze had let go so suddenly that the way of the ship brought the wet sails heavily against the mast. The spell of deadly stillness had caught us up again. There seemed to be no escape. "Hallo!" exclaimed Mr. Burns in a startled voice. "Calm again!" I addressed him as though he had been sane. "This is the sort of thing we've been having for 17 days, Mr. Burns," I said with intense bitterness. "A puff, then a calm, and in a moment, you'll see, she'll be swinging on her heel with her head away from her course to the devil somewhere." He caught at the word. "The old dodging devil!" he screamed piercingly, and burst into such a loud laugh as I had never heard before. It was a provoking, mocking peal, with a hair-raising, screeching over note of defiance. I stepped back, utterly confounded. Instantly there was a stir on the quarter-deck. Murmurs of dismay. A distressed voice cried out in the dark below us, "Who's that gone crazy now?" Perhaps they thought it was their captain. Rush is not the word that could be applied to the utmost speed the poor fellows were up to, but in an amazing short time every man in the ship able to walk upright had found his way onto that poop. I shouted to them, "It's the mate! Lay hold of him, a couple of you!" I expected this performance to end in a ghastly sort of fight, but Mr. Burns cut his derisive screeching dead short and turned upon them fiercely, yelling, "Ha, ha! Doggone ye! You've found your tongues, have you? I thought you were dumb. Well then, laugh, laugh, I tell you. Now then, all together, 1, 2, 3, laugh!" A moment of silence ensued, a silence so profound that you could have heard a pin drop on the deck. Then Ransom's unperturbed voice uttered pleasantly the words, "I think he has fainted, sir." The little motionless knot of men stirred with low murmurs of relief. "I've got him under the arms. Get hold of his legs, someone." Yes, it was a relief. He was silenced for a time, for a time. I could not have stood another peal of that insane screeching. I was sure of it, and just then Gambrel, the austere Gambrel, treated us to another vocal performance. He began to sing out for relief.
His voice wailed pitifully in the darkness. "Come aft, somebody. I can't stand this. Here she'll be off again directly, and I can't—"
I dashed aft myself, meeting on my way a hard gust of wind whose approach Gambrel's ear had detected from afar, and which filled the sails on the main in a series of muffled reports mingled with the low plaint of the spars. I was just in time to seize the wheel, while Frenchy, who had followed me, caught up the collapsing Gambrel. He hauled him out of the way, admonished him to lie still where he was, and then stepped up to relieve me, asking calmly, "How am I to steer her, sir?" "Dead before it for the present. I'll get you a light in a moment." But going forward I met Ransom bringing up the spare binnacle lamp. That man noticed everything, attended to everything, shed comfort around him as he moved. As he passed me, he remarked in a soothing tone that the stars were coming out. They were. The breeze was sweeping clear the sooty sky, breaking through the indolent silence of the sea. The barrier of awful stillness which had encompassed us for so many days as though we had been accursed was broken. I felt that. I let myself fall onto the skylight seat. A faint white ridge of foam, thin, very thin, broke alongside. The first for ages, for ages. I could have cheered if it hadn't been for the sense of guilt which clung to all my thoughts secretly. Ransom stood before me. "What about the mate?" I asked anxiously. "Still unconscious?" "Well, sir, it's funny." Ransom was evidently puzzled. "He hasn't spoken a word, and his eyes are shut, but it looks to me more like sound asleep than anything else." I accepted this view as the least troublesome of any, or at any rate least disturbing. Dead faint or deep slumber, Mr. Burns had to be left to himself for the present. Ransom remarked suddenly, "I believe you want a coat, sir." "I believe I do," I sighed out. But I did not move. What I felt I wanted were new limbs. My arms and legs seemed utterly useless, fairly worn out. They didn't even ache. But I stood up all the same to put on the coat when Ransom brought it up, and when he suggested that he had better now take Gambrel forward, I said, "All right, I'll help you to get him down on the main deck." I found that I was quite able to help, too. We raised Gambrel up between us. He tried to help himself along like a man, but all the time he was inquiring piteously, "You won't let me go when we come to the ladder. You won't let me go when we come to the ladder." The breeze kept on freshening and blew true to a hair. At daylight, by careful manipulation of the helm, we had got the foreyards to run square by themselves, the water keeping smooth, and then went about hauling the ropes tight. Of the four men I had with me at night, I could see now only two. I didn't inquire as to the others. They had given in, for a time only, I hoped. Our various tasks forward occupied us for hours. The two men with me moved so slow and had to rest so often. One of them remarked that every blamed thing in the ship felt about 100 times heavier than its proper weight. This was the only complaint uttered. I don't know what we should have done without Ransom. He worked with us, silent, too, with a little smile frozen on his lips. From time to time I murmured to him, "Go steady, take it easy, Ransom," and received a quick glance in reply. When we had done all we could to make things safe, he disappeared into his galley. Some time afterward, going forward for a look round, I caught sight of him through the open door. He sat upright on the locker in front of the stove, with his head leaning back against the bulkhead. His eyes were closed. His capable hands held open the front of his thin cotton shirt, baring tragically his powerful chest, which heaved in painful and laboured gasps. He didn't hear me. I retreated quietly and went straight on to the poop to relieve Frenchy, who by that time was beginning to look very sick. He gave me the course with great formality and tried to go off with a jaunty step, but reeled widely twice before getting out of my sight. And then I remained all alone aft, steering my ship, which ran before the wind with a buoyant lift now and then, and even rolling a little. Presently Ransom appeared before me with a tray. The sight of food made me ravenous all at once. He took the wheel while I sat down on the after grating to eat my breakfast. "This breeze seems to have done for our crowd," he murmured. "It just laid them low, all hands." "Yes," I said, "I suppose you and I are the only two fit men in the ship." "Frenchy says there's still a jump left in him. I don't know. It can't be much," continued Ransom, with his wistful smile. "Good little man, that. But suppose, sir, that this wind flies round when we are close to the land. What are we going to do with her?"
"If the wind shifts round heavily after we close in with the land, she will either run ashore or get dismasted, or both. We won't be able to do anything with her. She's running away with us now. All we can do is to steer her. She's a ship without a crew."
"Yes, all laid low," repeated Ransom quietly. "I do give them a look in forward every now and then, but it's precious little I can do for them."
"I and the ship and every one on board of her are very much indebted to you, Ransom," I said warmly.
He made as though he had not heard me, and steered in silence till I was ready to relieve him. He surrendered the wheel, picked up the tray, and for a parting shot informed me that Mr. Burns was awake and seemed to have a mind to come up on deck. "I don't know how to prevent him, sir. I can't very well stop down below all the time."
It was clear that he couldn't, and sure enough Mr. Burns came on deck, dragging himself painfully aft in his enormous overcoat. I beheld him with a natural dread. To have him around and raving about the wiles of a dead man while I had to steer a wildly rushing ship full of dying men was a rather dreadful prospect. But his first remarks were quite sensible in meaning and tone. Apparently he had no recollection of the night scene, and if he had, he didn't betray himself once. Neither did he talk very much. He sat on the skylight, looking desperately ill at first, but that strong breeze, before which the last remnant of my crew had wilted down, seemed to blow a fresh stock of vigour into his frame with every gust. One could almost see the process. By way of sanity test, I alluded on purpose to the late captain. I was delighted to find that Mr. Burns did not display undue interest in the subject. He ran over the old tale of that savage ruffian's iniquities with a certain vindictive gusto, and then concluded, unexpectedly, "I do believe, sir, that his brain began to go a year or more before he died." A wonderful recovery. I could hardly spare it as much admiration as it deserved, for I had to give all my mind to the steering. In comparison with the hopeless languor of the preceding days, this was dizzy speed. Two ridges of foam streamed from the ship's bows. The wind sang in a strenuous note which, under other circumstances, would have expressed to me all the joy of life. Whenever the hauled-up mainsail began trying to slat and bang itself to pieces in its gear, Mr. Burns would look at me apprehensively. "What would you have me to do, Mr. Burns? We can neither furl it nor set it. I only wish the old thing would thrash itself to pieces and be done with it. That beastly racket confuses me." Mr. Burns wrung his hands and cried out suddenly, "How will you get the ship into harbour, sir, without men to handle her?" And I couldn't tell him. Well, it did get done, about 40 hours afterward. By the exercising virtue of Mr. Burns' awful laugh, the malicious spectre had been laid, the evil spell broken, the curse removed. We were now in the hands of a kind and energetic providence that was rushing us on. I shall never forget the last night, dark, windy, and starry. I steered. Mr. Burns, after having obtained from me a solemn promise to give him a kick if anything happened, went frankly to sleep on the deck close to the binnacle. Convalescents need sleep. Ransom, his back propped against the mizzenmast and a blanket over his legs, remained perfectly still, but I don't suppose he closed his eyes for a moment. That embodiment of jauntiness, Frenchy, still under the delusion that there was a jump left in him, had insisted on joining us, but mindful of discipline, had laid himself down as far on the forepart of the poop as he could get, alongside the bucket rack. And I steered, too tired for anxiety, too tired for connected thought. I had moments of grim exultation, and then my heart would sink awfully at the thought of that forecastle at the other end of the dark deck, full of fever-stricken men, some of them dying. By my fault. But never mind, remorse must wait. I had to steer. In the small hours the breeze weakened, then failed altogether. About 5 it returned, gentle enough, enabling us to head for the roadstead. Daybreak found Mr. Burns sitting wedged up with coils of rope on the stern grating, and from the depths of his overcoat steering the ship with very white, bony hands, while Ransom and I rushed along the decks, letting go all the sheets and halyards by the run. We dashed next up onto the forecastle head. The perspiration of labour and sheer nervousness simply poured off our heads as we toiled to get the anchors cock-billed. I dared not look at Ransom as we worked side by side. We exchanged curt words. I could hear him panting close to me, and I avoided turning my eyes his way for fear of seeing him fall down and expire in the act of putting forth his strength. For what? Indeed, for some distinct ideal. The consummate seaman in him was aroused. He needed no directions. He knew what to do. Every effort, every movement was an act of consistent heroism. It was not for me to look at a man thus inspired. At last all was ready, and I heard him say, "Hadn't I better go down and open the compressors now, sir?" "Yes, do," I said. And even then I did not glance his way. After a time his voice came up from the main deck. "When you like, sir. All clear on the windlass here." I made a sign to Mr. Burns to put the helm down and let both anchors go, one after another, leaving the ship to take as much cable as she wanted. She took the best part of them both before she brought up. The loose sails, coming aback, ceased their maddening racket above my head. A perfect stillness reigned in the ship, and while I stood forward, feeling a little giddy in that sudden peace, I caught faintly a moan or two and the incoherent mutterings of the sick in the forecastle. As we had a signal for medical assistance flying on the mizzen, it is a fact that before the ship was fairly at rest, three steam launches from various men-of-war were alongside, and at least five naval surgeons had clambered on board. They stood in a knot, gazing up and down the empty main deck, then looked aloft, where not a man could be seen either. I went toward them, a solitary figure in a blue and grey striped sleeping suit and a pipe-clayed cork helmet on its head. Their disgust was extreme. They had expected surgical cases. Each one had brought his carving tools with him. But they soon got over their little disappointment. In less than 5 minutes, one of the steam launches was rushing shoreward to order a big boat and some hospital people for the removal of the crew. The big steam pinnace went off to her ship to bring over a few blue jackets to furl my sails for me. One of the surgeons had remained on board. He came out of the forecastle looking impenetrable and noticed my inquiring gaze. "There's nobody dead in there, if that's what you want to know," he said deliberately, then added in a tone of wonder, "The whole crew." "And very bad?" "And very bad," he repeated. His eyes were roaming all over the ship. "Heavens, what's that?" "That," I said, glancing aft, "is Mr. Burns, my chief officer." Mr. Burns, with his moribund head nodding on the stalk of his lean neck, was a sight for anyone to exclaim at. The surgeon asked, "Is he going to the hospital too?" "Oh, no," I said jocosely. "Mr. Burns can't go on shore till the mainmast goes. I'm very proud of him. He's my only convalescent." "You look," began the doctor, staring at me, but I interrupted him angrily. "I am not ill." "No, you look queer." "Well, you see, I've been 17 days on deck." 17? But you must have slept." "I suppose I must have. I don't know. But I'm certain that I didn't sleep for the last 40 hours." "Phew. You'll be going ashore presently, I suppose?" "As soon as ever I can. There's no end of business waiting for me there." The surgeon released my hand, which he had taken while we talked, pulled out his pocket-book, wrote in it rapidly, tore out the page, and offered it to me. "I strongly advise you to get this prescription made up for yourself ashore. Unless I'm much mistaken, you will need it this evening." "What is it, then?" I asked with suspicion. "Sleeping draught," answered the surgeon curtly, and moving with an air of interest towards Mr. Burns, he engaged him in conversation. As I went below to dress to go ashore, Ransom followed me. He begged my pardon. He wished, too, to be sent ashore and paid off. I looked at him in surprise. He was waiting for my answer with an air of anxiety. "You don't mean to leave the ship?" I cried out. "I do, really, sir. I want to go and be quiet somewhere. Anywhere. The hospital will do." "But, Ransom," I said, "I'd hate the idea of parting with you." "I must go," he broke in. "I have a right." He gasped, and a look of almost savage determination passed over his face.
For an instant he was another being. And I saw, under the worth and the comeliness of the man, the humble reality of things. Life was a boon to him, this precarious, hard life, and he was thoroughly alarmed about himself. "Of course I shall pay you off if you wish it," I hastened to say. "Only I must ask you to remain on board till this afternoon. I can't leave Mr. Burns absolutely by himself in the ship for hours." He softened at once and assured me with a smile and in his natural pleasant voice that he understood that very well. When I returned on deck, everything was ready for the removal of the men. It was the last ordeal of that episode which had been maturing and tempering my character, though I did not know it. It was awful. They passed under my eyes one after another, each of them an embodied reproach of the bitterest kind, till I felt a sort of revolt wake up in me. Poor Frenchy had gone suddenly under. He was carried past me insensible, his comic face horribly flushed and as if swollen, breathing stertorously. He looked more like Mr. Punch than ever, a disgracefully intoxicated Mr. Punch. The austere Gambrel, on the contrary, had improved temporarily. He insisted on walking on his own feet to the rail, of course, with assistance on each side of him. But he gave way to a sudden panic at the moment of being swung over the side, and began to wail pitifully, "Don't let them drop me, sir! Don't let them drop me, sir!" While I kept on shouting to him in most soothing accents, "All right, Gambrel, they won't, they won't." It was no doubt very ridiculous. The blue jackets on our deck were grinning quietly, while even Ransom himself, much to the fore in lending a hand, had to enlarge his wistful smile for a fleeting moment. I left for the shore in the steam pinnace, and on looking back beheld Mr. Burns actually standing up by the taffrail, still in his enormous woolly overcoat. The bright sunlight brought out his weirdness amazingly. He looked like a frightful and elaborate scarecrow set up on the poop of a death-stricken ship, set up to keep the seabirds from the corpses. Our story had got about already in town, and everybody on shore was most kind. The marine office let me off the port dues, and as there happened to be a shipwrecked crew staying in the home, I had no difficulty in obtaining as many men as I wanted. But when I inquired if I could see Captain Ellis for a moment, I was told in accents of pity for my ignorance that our deputy Neptune had retired and gone home on a pension about 3 weeks after I left the port. So I suppose that my appointment was the last act, outside the daily routine, of his official life. It is strange how, on coming ashore, I was struck by the springy step, the lively eyes, the strong vitality of everyone I met. It impressed me enormously. And amongst those I met there was Captain Giles, of course. It would have been very extraordinary if I had not met him. A prolonged stroll in the business part of the town was the regular employment of all his mornings when he was ashore. I caught the glitter of the gold watch-chain across his chest ever so far away. He radiated benevolence. "What is it, I hear?" he queried with a kind uncle smile after shaking hands. 21 days from Bangkok. "Is this all you've heard?" I said. "You must come to tiffin with me if you want to know exactly what you have let me in for." He hesitated for almost a minute. "Well, I will," he said condescendingly at last. We turned into the hotel. I found to my surprise that I could eat quite a lot. Then, over the cleared tablecloth, I unfolded to Captain Giles the history of these 20 days in all its professional and emotional aspects, while he smoked patiently the big cigar I had given him. Then he observed sagely, "You must feel jolly well tired by this time." "No," I said, "not tired. But I'll tell you, Captain Giles, how I feel. I feel old, and I must be. All of you on shore look to me just a lot of skittish youngsters that have never known a care in the world." He didn't smile. He looked insufferably exemplary. He declared, "That will pass, but you do look older. That's a fact." "Aha," I said. "No, no. The truth is that one must not make too much of anything in life, good or bad." "Life at half speed," I murmured perversely. "Not everybody can do that." "You'll be glad enough presently if you can keep going even at that rate," he retorted with his air of conscious virtue. "And there's another thing. A man should stand up to his bad luck, to his mistakes, to his conscience and all that sort of thing. Why, what else would you have to fight against?
I kept silent. I don't know what he saw in my face, but he asked abruptly, Why, you aren't faint-hearted?
God only knows, Captain Giles, was my sincere answer.
That's all right, he said calmly. You will learn soon how not to be faint-hearted. A man has got to learn everything, and that's what so many of them youngsters don't understand.
Well, I'm no longer a youngster.
No, he conceded.
Are you leaving soon?
I'm going on board directly, I said. I shall pick up one of my anchors and heave in to half cable on the other directly my new crew comes on board, and I shall be off at daylight tomorrow.
You will, grunted Captain Giles approvingly. That's the way. You'll do.
What did you think, that I would want to take a week ashore for a rest? I said, irritated by his tone. There's no rest for me till she's out in the Indian Ocean, and not much of it even then.
He puffed at his cigar moodily, as if transformed.
Yes, that's what it amounts to, he said in a musing tone.
It was as if a ponderous curtain had rolled up, disclosing an unexpected Captain Giles. But it was only for a moment, just the time to let him add, Precious little time in life for anybody. Better not think of it.
We rose, left the hotel, and parted from each other in the street with a warm handshake, just as he began to interest me for the first time in our intercourse. The first thing I saw when I got back to the ship was Ransom on the quarter-deck, sitting quietly on his neatly lashed sea-chest. I beckoned him to follow me into the saloon, where I sat down to write a letter of recommendation for him to a man I knew on shore. When finished, I pushed it across the table. It may be of some good to you when you leave the hospital. He took it, put it in his pocket. His eyes were looking away from me, nowhere. His face was anxiously set.
"'How are you feeling now?' I asked.
"'I don't feel bad now, sir,' he answered stiffly. "'But I am afraid of its coming on.' "'The wistful smile came back on his lips for a moment. "'I'm in a blue funk about my heart, sir.' "'I approached him with an extended hand. "'His eyes, not looking at me, had a strained expression. "'It was like a man listening for a warning call. "'Won't you shake hands, Ransom?' I said gently.
He exclaimed, flushed up dusky red, gave my hand a hard wrench, and next moment, left alone in the cabin, I listened to him going up the companion stairs cautiously, step by step, in mortal fear of starting into sudden anger our common enemy. It was his hard fate to carry consciously within his faithful breast.
End of The Shadow Line.